On Education is called to order for this Wednesday, September 13th, 2006. Just a refresher on the scope and purview of this specific committee is to review and analyze and discuss and inform our thinking and thought processes on education reform in the state of Oregon, K-12, from private sector partners. And this morning we're very, very happy to have with us a significant partner in this whole dialogue, discussion, and exploration, the Oregon Business Council and the Employers for Education Excellence. And I certainly appreciate the wealth of information that you have brought to us. Jill Kirk and Duncan Weiss, I think you're going to be lead off and introduce your colleagues, and we welcome you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Duncan Wise. I'm president of the Oregon Business Council. We are delighted to be here. With me is the council's vice president, Jill Kirk. I'll introduce her and the rest of the team in just a moment. We are thrilled to have this opportunity to give us this extended time with you. Jill is going to lead us through the day. She'll give you an agenda in a moment, but we see this as an opportunity to share with you a lot of the work we've been doing over the last several years on education. And actually, we're going to be talking pre-K through 20 because our view is we've got to blur the lines here and to get where we need to go. And we'd like to share our ideas and, above all, engage in a dialogue with you. I mean, we're going to leave lots of time for discussion. If you listen to 3 hours of PowerPoints, I'm afraid it would be deadening, and so we will not do that. But we have a series of presenters who I think will spark your attention and stimulate conversation, and that's really what we're trying to do. Before we get started, I'd just like to briefly introduce the Business Council, who we are, and just so you have context. I know many of you know this, but we have a lot of pieces to our organization now, and so I think it's worth you understanding who we are. And again, before I introduce the council, I am also on the State Board of Education. I can answer questions today if you want in that capacity, but this is, in terms of my role, I'm speaking on behalf of the council. About OBC, our mission, we're a group of about 50 business executives. The Oregon Business Magazine captured how I like to think about it last week, and they said it's the who's who of civically active CEOs. That's how we like to think of ourselves. These are folks who want to come together to work on Oregon issues, our mission is to mobilize them and help them support the work in Oregon that make the community a better place. We have identified education as a critical priority for Oregon and have been involved in education for over two decades, working on both K-12 issues and higher education issues, we've been very involved in the policy making in the legislature as well as in the executive branch and in individual school districts for many, many years. Out of that work along the way, along with our policy work, we thought it was very important to get engaged more hands-on in the communities, and we created a new organization which is affiliated with us called E3, Employers for Education Excellence. They do all kinds of work at the community level under Renee Jay's leadership, working on partnerships with the businesses and schools. One of our largest partnerships, by far our largest partnership, is one that we've been pleased to participate in, which is the Small Schools Initiative funded by the Gates and Meyer Memorial Trust. And Karen Phillips is here to talk about that work today and how it nests nicely with our policy work. About 2 years ago, in looking at our education work, we decided to create a roundtable that included business leaders, education leaders, both from higher ed and K-12 and community colleges, as well as philanthropic leaders and legislators, to just get in a roundtable discussion about education policy issues. We were funded by the Oregon Community Foundation and the Lumina Foundation to give us resources to do policy work, and we prepared for that roundtable, and for you, frankly, ultimately, a series of white papers on education policy, which you have at your desks, six white papers. For us, it was a moment of review and reflection, and we have come up with what we think is a pretty bold new vision for education that, again, combines our work on K-12 with higher ed and presents to you, I think, a very different vision for where we ought to be taking our education system in Oregon, and that's what we're going to be presenting to you today. That group is ongoing and will continue to do work. We have more work papers in preparation. And again, all that work is available to you. We'll be presenting it today, and we hope this is a source of continued resource for you as we move forward. Finally, so we have the Education Roundtable, we have the OBC and its policy work. Finally, one of our products is the Oregon Business Plan. Yesterday, we shot out an email announcing the fifth annual Leadership Summit, Leadership Committee that includes Speaker Minnis, the two U.S. Senators, the Governor, and the Senate President. Announced the fourth, we're going to be convening once again at the Convention Center. And, of course, one of the key priorities in the Oregon Business Plan is education improvement. We use that as an opportunity to bring the business community together to focus on a policy agenda for Oregon. So that's who we are. Now, what I'd like to do is introduce the team. Jill Kirk is the Vice President of OBC. Jill has a long history in these issues. She worked for many years at Tektronix and Human Resources and Community Affairs. She has served on the State Board of Education for over 8 years, including several as chair. She came to OBC about 2.5 years ago and has just done a fantastic job in bringing our education work together. We have a great team. Joe Courtwright from Impreza is our economist. He helps us on the Oregon Business Plan and also on our analysis of education and workforce issues. And he's going to be talking about why education and economy are basically two sides of the same coin and why it's vital for our economic future. Karen Phillips has got a background in education. She was the deputy superintendent at North Clackamas School District. When we brought her in to lead our E3 work on small schools, she has put together an incredible team working with, I think we're at 46 schools, is that right now? We have 46 schools under our umbrella in the Small Schools Initiative now, and she has just a fantastic team of coaches to help them, and she will share her wisdom. John DePonia is, you met last time when the chalkboard presented. Chalkboard and we share John, and we work very closely with him and Chalkboard. He'll talk about the budget vision we have, and I think he shared a little bit last time, but he'll give you the vision of budget as a key tool for managing change in education. And then Kristen, who's just joined OBC, she's got a law degree and education background. She's been a teacher, and she's a great policy analyst, and she's going to help share a little bit more information with you on our vision for the budget as a policy tool. We've got a busy morning, and Jill Kirk will lead you through it. And I think, again, we hope to engage in a dialogue with you as we present our speakers. We're really looking forward to the conversation we have with you. Thanks.
Thank you, Duncan. And just before we move forward, Jill, when is that next OBC gathering?
It's January 4th.
January
Thursday, right before the U.S. senators have decided, given the schedule, that we will... they will be in session in December after the election, and so we usually would do it in December, but they said that they want to be there, and so we're going to do it that first week, right?
Perfect.
Before legislative
Thank
session.
You.
It'll be, and we will be bringing a fresh new set of policy agendas in all the areas, education, transportation. We're really eager to refresh the business plan, and I think you're going to be really excited about the policy work we're doing.
Thank you.
Thanks, Duncan. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're very glad to be here, and we're going to take you through a kind of a quick course in what we've been thinking about and why we think it's important. We're going to begin. I'll just go over the agenda, and then we will begin with it. We're going to start by really hammering in a particular point, which is so important as a place to begin, which is why does this matter so much? So, and Joe Courtwright will help us with that. We'll talk a little bit about the goals that Oregon might want to hold for itself in terms of education, look at how we're doing, and think about how we might get from here to there. I'll do that piece, and I promise you I'll do it as quickly as I can, so that we can then dive much more deeply into the really interesting part of our recommendation to you around some structure changes. And that's what we have brought these experts who are sitting with us to talk to you about. And finally, we'll conclude with some implications of all this, we think, for your own decision-making processes and how you might think about going forward from that. So with that, I will turn things over to Joe Courtwright, who will talk with you about making the case for change.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Joe Courtright. I'm an economist with Impresa, and I work with the Business Council on the business plan and on education reform. What I'd like to briefly talk about is just review with you some of the economic evidence on why education and educational attainment are so important, both to the economic health of Oregonians and Oregon's families, but also to the fiscal health of the state. And it turns out to be the major driver behind a lot of the budget consequences that you have to deal with on a day-to-day and session-by-session basis. And to do that, I mean, and I think what I'll be doing is confirming your intuition. These are things that are not big surprises to you, but there's really very strong economic and statistical evidence to support the intuition you have probably about the importance of education to economic well-being of families and then also to the state. And I'll be talking about the stakes of education. And I'll talk about this in terms of how it influences the income of Oregonians and then how it in turn influences the income and expenditures of the state of Oregon. The one thing that we know is that in Oregon, as nationally, there's a very strong correlation between educational attainment, the number of years of schooling that people have completed, the advanced degrees that they've attained, and their income. So fewer than a fifth of the households with an income of less than $25,000 in the state have anybody in the household with a four-year degree. And more than three in five households with incomes over $100,000 have somebody in the household with a four-year degree. And if you look at the median incomes of individuals in the state, it's about almost a two-to-one relationship. That is, somebody with a college degree earns twice as much as somebody with just a high school diploma in the state. Those are the median levels. So the average person with a college degree now in the state of Oregon earns about double what the family with just a high school degree earns. And I think I may have skipped in there. Thank you. And there's been a remarkable change in the last two decades in terms of the importance of education to earnings. It's always been the case that people with higher levels of education earn more, but that relationship has become stronger over the last couple of decades. So these are two charts that show in inflation-adjusted dollars what people with various educations made, first in 1975, and you can see there's this strong progression, and then in 2003, which were the latest years for which I had data. I'm just going to give you a little back and forth on that so you can see how much that jumped between 1975, how much steeper it became between 1975 and 2003. So we know that there's this very strong relationship for individuals between education and income. And what is true for individuals is also true for communities and for states. Places that have better educated populations have higher levels of income. You can explain about 60% of the variation in incomes between states simply by knowing the education level of the population in the state. It's the single biggest explanatory factor that's out there. There's a lot of debate in economics from time to time about what's important. It's just abundantly clear from the evidence that education is critical to state income. And you see that in these household income numbers as well. The first data I was showing you was earnings for individuals, but households that have somebody in them with a college degree earn a lot more than households that earn less. And you can see it's, again, about a 2-to-1 ratio now. Now, all I've talked about up until now is how this influences the well-being of families and households. But this translates in a very straightforward way to state finances. Because simply put, if you were to describe the way state finances work in Oregon, we get tax revenues from families that have educations, and we spend it on families and individuals who, by today's standards, don't have good educations. The bulk of our income comes from people who are well-educated and pay lots of income taxes because they earn high incomes. And the bulk of our expenditures are driven by people who don't have educations and therefore are big demanders of some of the most expensive state services. And I'll walk you through some of the statistical data. We know that there's a strong negative correlation, for example, between your educational attainment level and your likelihood of being enrolled in the Oregon health plan. Those without a high school diploma are about 10 times as likely to be institutionalized. That's being a state institution, could be the correctional system or mental institutions. So there's a really strong correlation there in terms of driving costs. These are the numbers for the health plan. You can see that about almost one in five persons in the state who has less than a high school degree are enrolled in the health plan or on the Medicaid system, compared with about 2 to 3% of the people with a bachelor's degree. So, simply put, the more we move people from the left-hand side of the chart to the right-hand side of the chart, the less likely they are to demand or need public assistance with medical care. Same thing is true of institutionalization. Again, the institutionalization rate is not really high, but it's about 10 times higher for people who are high school dropouts than it is for people who have completed a college degree. And when you look across the line at state programs that provide assistance, there's a really strong correlation, again, between educational attainment. Holds for the institutionalized population, also for welfare recipients, and also holds for people in the unemployment insurance system as well. And I'll just show you some of the data here. The red line is the ratio for the overall population, and you can see that most of the people who are institutionalized, who are receiving welfare, the TANF program, or are receiving assistance through the federal SSI program, more than three-fifths of them have a high school education or less. So the bulk of the demand for those programs is really driven by the education level of the population. Same thing is true in the broader healthcare system. People without a high school diploma are much more likely to be have no health insurance, private health insurance, much more likely to be on the Oregon Health Plan, much more likely to be in the Medicare program as well. And then finally, this extends to a wide variety of areas. If you look at the unemployment insurance system in the state, the bulk of the recipients of unemployment insurance at any one time are people who have either just a high school education or less than high school. And you can see that there's about three-quarters, almost 75%, of the people who are drawing UI in the period during which we did this study were people who had just a high school degree or less than a high school degree, and that they are about one-third to about 60% more likely than the overall population to be drawing unemployment insurance. So, to review the evidence, it's real clear that education is more important than ever to household income. In Oregon, where we depend heavily on the income tax, the bulk of our tax revenues come from those families who have a good education and are earning high incomes. And state costs are overwhelmingly driven by those households and those individuals who don't have good education. So we have a very strong interest in the state over time of raising the level of education of our population. It will benefit the revenue side of our equation by generating more revenue with any given tax system or tax level, and it will also lower the costs of providing some of our most expensive public services.
Any questions on some of the baseline information here?
Could I just offer? We're going to offer commentary as we go, if that's all right, Madam Chair. I'm reflecting on. I heard on the radio, Madam Chair, your comments on civics. We would point out, while we're making the economic argument here, you could also make the argument about civic education, higher levels of education, whether they're in high school or in college, make better citizens, more effective in the political realm. The benefits of education also extend in personal lives in terms of ability to navigate this more complicated world. So we think for a whole bunch of reasons, the economic data is the easiest to see, but for civic engagement, for individual living a rich life as an individual, as well as the economic argument, we think it's that education levels are compelling. And we'd stress that while Joe's numbers are based on degrees, really what's essential isn't so much degree, it's actually learning. You know, it's having the knowledge and skills. And so there are those with high school educations who are very well educated and are able to navigate, and there are, frankly, those who may have a college education who don't have the skills. Ultimately, this is about skills. It's easier to use the data on levels because that's more readily available, but what we're really talking about is high skills matter in the 21st century.
And thank you for that, Duncan, because I would hasten to also insert that civics component is a very integral part of impetus for the establishment of the public school system so many generations ago, et cetera, and we can have that discussion down the trail.
Absolutely great.
Thank you, Joe. with that basis laid, that there are economic and other intrinsic values of education for individuals and for communities, we might take a look at what some of Oregon's goals ought to look like in terms of education attainment for its citizens. So we'll offer you seven that have emerged as we have worked through our thinking, and then we'll sort of have you hold those in your mind as we go through the rest of our presentation. A first an important goal might well be that essentially all Oregon students, or as many as possible, graduate from high school ready for work, for further learning, and for citizenship, to that earlier point. That's a very crucial piece. That we know, in order to achieve that we know that an increased proportion of students are on track as they are moving through that K-12 pipeline, so that they're able to graduate on time and with the proficiencies that would be required. That we'd have more, a higher proportion of Oregonians would have degrees, post-secondary degrees, and an increased proportion of Oregonians would have marketable skills that might be developed through combinations of post-secondary work and apprenticing and achieving technical skills and so forth. So this is not aimed just at shooting everyone into a university. That's really not what we're talking about here, but we're talking about very broadly and very deeply raising the quality of education for everyone and making sure that everyone is able to leave their educational experience with some security, that they will be able to operate in the economy. As Pat Callan talked to us a while back, if you leave without about two pretty good solid years of post-secondary work, you're not guaranteed to be successful in the economy. But if you leave with that, you're not guaranteed success. But if you leave before that, you're almost certain to be punished in the near future. We want to make sure as well that we don't focus our thinking on education just with people who are young and going through the education experience sort of for the first time, that there will be many opportunities and requirements for people to come back into learning environments, that we'll need to have really world-class institutions, and that these outcomes can be achieved at some price that we are able to pay. So with that as a sort of a frame, let's take a look at what that might kind of translate into in more tangible terms. If we wanted to really raise the educational attainment to put ourselves in the sort of position that Joe was describing as being attractive, we might want to have something fairly aggressive, like at least 40% of Oregonians move from high school and into some kind of a technical certification or associate degree program, and that's where they would exit the system. That beyond that, another 20% would have gone on to at least a four-year degree, and that beyond that, another 20% might have a graduate or a professional degree. So let's take a look at what kind of a change that would require. If we look at how we're doing now, which is the column on your left, we can see that there are a lot of Oregonians, 12.5%, who have less than a high school degree as of 05 data. That a large number have a high school degree or equivalent, and bear in mind that these are the high school requirements that are in place now and have been in the past. They're not thinking in terms of the higher levels that are coming forward. Some college, a quarter of our population has at some point taken at least a class in college. We don't have a high number of people with that associate degree, however, about 7%. We've got about 20% with a bachelor's degree, almost 18% at any rate, which is a good thing, and I think reflects a lot of the very high in-migration into the state of highly educated people, and another 10% with degrees beyond that. But you can see that the the spread looks quite different if you say we want to assume that everyone finishes high school successfully and that beyond that there are levels of success that people would achieve. So this is a large-scale change. I mean, these are not small incremental changes that we're kind of thinking about. These would be fairly large changes in the ways that we do things. So are we on track to do that? How are we doing now? Well, if we look at the preschool end of the system, because we want to be talking with you about the entire education system, preschool through the university experience, So we'll take a look at some data points along the way. Only 60% of those students who are eligible in Oregon are being served by Head Start. If we look at the fourth grade, we've got it looks like a pretty good achievement rate on reading and math standards in the high 80s. However, if we look at those same students and their scores on the national education tests, then we see that we're not comparing as favorably, that the proficiency level against that national test is much lower than our achievement to our state standards might indicate. So we just need to bear that in mind, and the state board, of course, will pay great attention to that as they look at setting the standards. If we look at eighth grade, similar picture except lower. Now we have achievement to standards in the mid-60s rather than in the 80s on the state tests, and we have sort of low 30s proficiency scores in terms of the national proficiency test. And at 10th grade, we drop again. We have 55% of our students meeting standards in reading, barely 45% meeting standards in math. Writing standards are continuing actually to decline. There is not a 10th grade equivalent for that national test.
Jill?
Yes.
Before you move forward from that, would you like to offer some explanation as to the wide variation between our state standards and the national standards?
Well, I may not be competent to do that fully. There is some suggestion, I think, that the state standards are skewed a bit so that they are somewhat more stringent at the higher grades and a little less stringent at the lower grades. So they may not be consistent as they march up, which would explain the difference, perhaps explain some of the difference in the achievement levels. But in comparing standards, Oregon standards, to the NAEP standards, they are, of course, different tests. They're not designed to be exactly parallel, and we use them only because there isn't any other way of making a good comparison with national standards, because every state sets its own standards differently. So it would be a choice that Oregon could make to say that what it wants to do is to set standards so that we can understand be able to be performing to a higher level at the NAEP level, at the national level. There is also an international standard, the TIMSS studies, which I think most of you know a lot about, and the same pattern really is applicable there. And so I think the short answer is there needs to be an overhaul of the assessment system that lines up and helps us align the movement of students through the K-12 system so that they really are prepared for their next steps into post-secondary and into their lives, and that the standards as they are set now may not do that as well as they could. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important for us to look at the whole system and to include what the university systems and the community colleges really need and expect the students to be able to do, so that we create a continuum of work for students across the line.
Do you mind if we interpose questions?
Oh, this
before
is a good
you go
time. This is a good time to.
We're going to dialogue
yeah,
here.
That's good luck.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Chair. Have we looked, or have you looked at states where their alignment is closer, where a state testing and the national testing are more similarly aligned so that they come out closer? And If so, could you give us some of that information?
There are states whose students score more higher on the NAEP test than Oregon students do. Those states, I think, have been longer at the process of working towards standards. Many of them have had exit standards in place in their high schools for a long time, so they're really sort of accustomed to working toward a higher goal and a goal of transitioning students out of high school and into their next step. Colorado, Massachusetts are a couple of states who do that extremely well.
Follow up. The other question that always comes to mind is have colleges and others looked at the standard and business, looked at the standards to see if that's really what they want the kids to know? I mean, are the standards the appropriate ones, including NAEP or ours?
Duncan,
do you want to swing into board mode?
You're leaping ahead a little bit to the presentation. Our vision is that the standards need to be aligned pre-K through 20, so that as you navigate through the system, when you meet standards in high school, you know you're ready for your next step. That's the vision we all need to share. I know that's where the state board is going. We need to have our higher ed partners at the table, and they are, as we do the high school diploma changes. To follow on Jill's comment on the standards, just recall that the whole standards movement is actually relatively new in the history of education in America. And the standards in place and the assessments are roughly now 10, 15 years old, and we're learning. And the NAEP's relatively new. All of this is new. And the department, with some support from the Gates Foundation, is reviewing the state standards, and we're going to look at the assessment systems to see what adjustments need to be made. And again, as Jill said, there may be some issues about the standards at the different grade levels. It's very complicated. And again, the big news in Oregon and in America is that we're focusing on standards. Again, go back 20 years, that wasn't the case. We had education delivery, but we didn't really know what the outcomes are. We're learning a lot more, and I would argue we need to continuously improve our systems to get better at this, and not, you know, and that's exactly what we're doing.
Duncan, just to pick up on a comment you made there, the NAEP is relatively new, but the National Assessment for Education Progress has been around since 71 or 72, has it not?
Yeah, it's been around.
That's
a while.
30-some years.
Yeah, it's a while, but again, for Oregon, the standards...
Older than I am.
Yeah, the
Oregon... the actual... The first national literacy assessment, I've forgotten the date, but it's all... As we started to do, and I'm not a historian, maybe some of you recall, but the movement to really trying to get comparable data on education is a relative. It came out of the 84, the America's the Nation at Risk study, and we started collecting data. It's again for the education community. It's a relatively new enterprise, and it's we believe it's critically important. Again, we can argue about the standards and argue about the assessment systems, and we can certainly have a discussion of that. But we really do need to know how well kids are doing across the system.
Representative Gelzer, Representative Morgan, and Dawn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It always strikes me when looking at assessment data that as the kids get older, the achievement drops. Is that something that's unique to Oregon, or is that consistent across the nation?
It is not. It is not exclusive to Oregon at all. It is a pattern that is... almost uniform. I don't think there is a state that shows a different pattern, in fact, from that. And we will, as Duncan says, your questions are anticipating our presentation a bit, but we will get to some of the reasons why we think that is, and see what we might suggest that could possibly break into that pattern, because that's damaging to those students.
And a quick follow-up?
Follow-up.
And this might go into that later presentation, but it also strikes me when I look at this data that when we talk about education reform and recommendations, almost always we're focusing on younger grades, and even the Chalkboard Project has recommendations that are very focused on kindergarten and lower class sizes in kindergarten and first grade. And do you see that impacting this achievement for older students, or do you think that reform is needed also for these older students as they get closer to leaving our educational system?
I believe that it is quite clear that the better job you do, the younger the student, then that benefit will continue if you have got a system that's well constructed and aligned so that the student can logically transition through it. So sometimes I think it's possible that we focus on very early grades because they're, in a lot of ways, that's easier to think about and easier to manage, and it gets harder and messier the longer you go. And when you start talking about the teenage years, we all know what a difficult problem that is. But what we are talking about is that whole spectrum, and we actually will be focusing in this presentation more on that difficult end than we will on the earlier end, knowing that you got a wonderful presentation from Chalkboard just a month ago on that.
Great, thank you.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you. I think part of my question you've already answered, but I was curious about the piece of what you're proposing that deals with exit competencies, with having some kind of a bar that students would need to cross over before they were judged to be competent to graduate from high school. And it seems like in the state of Oregon, we've taken some kind of stabs at that. The SIM and the CAM would probably be things that would fall into that category, but they're kind of arcane and weird in the national or international sense of how you measure people. And we do the assessments for the statewide standards through the course of the students progressing through the system. I'm curious, we have both of you that serve on the state board, what the discussions are at the board level around competencies and why the state is coming to the place that we're coming to now where people are recognizing that there needs to be another set of competencies put in place.
Well, since I'm the current member of the state board, I will reply, and this is the state board hat on, but we are in the process of reviewing the high school diploma requirements. And as we do that, also looking at the underlying curriculum associated with it, including your work that you've already done on increasing the math requirements. And where we're, the basic, I think, agreement among the board is that we want the high school diploma to be meaningful in terms of the next step partners, which include higher education, community colleges part of higher education, and employers who are wanting to hire well-educated, talented young people. And we're setting the framework is to set a bar that includes the proficiencies you might think of. We want everyone to be able to demonstrate they can read, to write, to apply math, and also to master some core content, including classic English, social sciences, sciences. And we're trying to design a diploma which in some ways will be traditional. We'll have curriculum and requirements that you'll know, the Carnegie Unis, your classes, but it will also be built into it demonstrations that you know how to do those fundamental essential skills. And we think that diploma, backed up by an assessment system and a series of standards associated with courses, will give Oregonian young people a leg up in terms of their next steps and really make them highly competitive. Now, those will be the requirements. Obviously, then the schools themselves will be responsible for delivering the programs, and we have a whole lot of issues around, what do those schools look like. But as Karen will suggest, I think, we believe that if we set a very high bar and challenge the institutions to meet it, there are models out there to deliver on that promise. The other promise that I know we've talked about in the past that I think is also essential to this new design is if you meet the standards earlier, you can take college-level classes as part of your high school experience. And I know that's something you've been interested in. But so those who can more rapidly meet the standards and want to be doing college-level work can do it and get those credits behind them before they leave. And so, again, the vision here is for a system that connects the students with their next steps seamlessly so they know that when they graduate, they're ready to go, and that if they want to move faster, they can do that and move along in their education.
Just a comment, probably, that one of the problems that was real apparent with SIM and CAM were that they were competencies that were kind of spinning off in their own little universe, and you couldn't relate them to anything else that was going on in education in the national arena. Mm-hmm. And I think that the work that we've all done with what we call the Ballot Measure 1 report, mm-hmm. where we're trying to find out whether the level of funding is adequate. Part of the problem we've got is that there is no coordinated national way of measuring how well the systems all do. You've got, each state has its own thing. Each district is a bunch of subsets under each state, mm-hmm. and they're doing their own thing. And it's real difficult to have a rational, fact-based discussion about how one system is functioning in terms of how the rest of the system is functioning.
Oh, got it. Can I take that one on, too? And then, Jill, quickly, I'm sorry, that you're on, too. I apologize. This is a big... Basically, the question, it really raises the assessment. And one of the things we're looking at is there are national assessment tools that you can use that also then are good, useful for students to mark their own learning and where their next step. So one of the opportunities is to use a national assessment. I'll leave it at that.
Pending the buy-in from a lot of folks. And I'm sorry, Representative Dahlem's burning for a question, and then we'll move forward, Bill.
I have my question written down because I always feel like I'm two steps behind Representative Morgan. How many, and I think I have a logical follow-up to where she's been going. When we look at 65%, 68% performance on our own test and then drop down to the 33s, how many states write their own assessment and adjudicate progress against their own assessment and then somersault it into something that can be converted to a national norming process?
Well, virtually all states now, because of the national the No Child Left Behind Act, which requires all states to set their own standards. So there are very few standards that are consistent state to state.
Joe, what I'm asking is how many? Thank you. How many states are writing their own assessment?
Oh, I'm sorry, their own assessment. You know, I don't know exactly the answer to that. There are a number of states that are using assessments that come from publishing companies and so forth. And I think that the majority probably are buying. Is that right?
I don't know. Yeah.
Sure. We'll have to find that for you to get that exactly right.
If we're going to compete with those people and look like we're doing 33% of the work, I would certainly like our professional people to have a more standardized measure of their accomplishment to hold their work against. It would seem more fair to our people and our students if we assessed against what we're going to be compared to.
Right, right.
Here,
we
there,
do,
and everywhere.
We do have a...
Oh, yeah, you want to talk
about it? I just want to make one comment.
For the record, we need your name.
Thank you. Karen Phillips, Director of the Oregon Small Schools Initiative with E3. But just a follow-up, Representative Dahlem, in that even for the states that contract and buy an assessment from a private company, what Duncan was mentioning is I think the challenge for Oregon and other states is that every state has a different system. So when we're comparing 30% or 60% or 50%, none of those numbers are comparable. We're comparing apples to oranges in terms of what students really know. And so back to what Representative Morgan said, what we need is national standards and or assessments, and as we move forward, we're going to share a couple thoughts about that so that when you are looking at how are Oregon students achieving, you have a better sense of is that good, bad, or do other states know more than we do, etc.
Thank you.
So moving along as we go through these levels, we presently have about a 69% high school graduation rate. That is relatively consistent with national averages. Of those high school graduates, about 73% of them in 05 went on into post-secondary. And of those who entered the university system, there's about an 80% retention of freshmen into the sophomore year. In terms of graduating in 4 years with a bachelor's degree, about 28% of undergraduates achieve that. 56% of undergraduates achieve what used to be thought of as a four-year degree in 6 years. There are a number of reasons for that, including the very sharply escalating cost of university degrees. But what these data are intended to demonstrate that if our objective as a state is to move a whole lot of people through to the highest possible levels of education attainment, we're not doing it. and that our system is only as strong as the weakest link. We start losing students surprisingly early in that pipeline. Sometimes even as early as in the earliest grades, kids just kind of click off.
And
so we have to think
question,
about the
please.
Whole continuum.
Speaker Minnan.
One of the concerns that have been expressed is about articulation between universities, and sometimes
yes.
they'll take credits from another institution, and oftentimes they don't. What progress has been made to try to streamline that and get the universities to work together? Because I think that does contribute to the length of how long it takes to get through a college education.
Exactly. It's been a huge barrier. It's one of those transition points that's a huge barrier for students. There has been a lot of work done on it. The university system, the community college system, and K-12 have been working hard together to try to work out arrangements and agreements about how credits will transfer. But it is still a fairly awkward structure. They are trying to patch some structural separations that are hard to patch over.
Could you give me an example of that? I understand Portland State has a different kind of a closed caste system that once you start with them, it's a very difficult. My daughter goes to Portland State.
Right.
She's going to graduate this year.
Right.
Thank goodness. But, if she needed to transfer, it would be difficult just because of the structure of how they have their credits and that kind of thing. So could you kind of expound on that a little bit and talk about what the challenges are?
Well, the challenges are that these institutions have, and this is not just Oregon, and this has not necessarily been a bad thing in the past, but these institutions have been very autonomous, and they have been able to construct their own policies and what they think is valid and rigorous, and they set that up. And there has been, I think, traditionally a kind of a hesitation to think that professors at a sister institution are just quite as careful about wanting the top level of quality as we are. So there have been many, many cases where students have tried to transfer either from a community college into a university or from a university to another university, and their credits just simply haven't been accepted. That math at OSU is not that math at the University of Oregon. And so they have to take another class or they have to start over again. And by losing time, losing credits, losing dollars, we really all lose in that transaction. So that what now the Board of Higher Education has put together, as you know, some work groups that have been working very hard on trying to streamline those processes and come to some agreements around core content areas, so that if you have a credit in a certain area, that's a credit. And if you move to another Oregon institution, it will be accepted as a credit.
I think they began this conversation during the last legislative
session. Yes.
Do you expect that they're going to come forward with a proposal? Or do you think it's going to take a legislation to get them to come to the table and cooperate with each other? Or do you think you're going to be able to work out agreements at the board level?
Well, there was legislation, and they've been responding. Actually, my understanding, and I'm not fully briefed on this, is we've had more progress in the last 12 months on this than in a long, long time. The community colleges and higher ed have really come together on agreeing on what the core curriculum requirements are, so that and then also agreeing on the AP standard, so an AP class means the same wherever you go. So there's a lot of great work. It's just these are, if you include K-12, three separate systems and often independent schools. So figuring out how to create a common curriculum design that allows students to flow is really, it's a challenging problem. And I think all are of very good will right now. So I think we're really lucky. And I mean, you sparked the conversation through your legislation, forget what bill number last time. And with the joint boards are very, very focused on this. But again, these are different systems. And my dream is, again, that you take a college level class in high school, you get college credit, where the community college or higher ed, and we have a common definition. That is a major challenge in system design.
Well, I do think it makes it more difficult for the student in the long run to achieve. You know, it's discouraging to know that you've taken a course,
yeah.
and then you want to move on to the next item, and they say, sorry, you didn't take it here, so you have to pay twice.
Right.
And just a quick additional comment. It's not just the credits. It's also for placement. If you take a pre-calc class in high school and you can't go on to the calculus in college, that's very frustrating for students, and that happens all the time. And so we also need to make sure that, regardless of the credits, that we have common definitions for placement.
Curriculum and alignment.
So do you, one last question, Madam Chair, I apologize. So do you think that legislation will be necessary next session? To encourage the institutions to come to an agreement? Or do you think it's too soon to say this is September and we reconvene in January? Do you think that it's going to take a legislative action to get them to come to an agreement?
I really don't know the answer to that question. I can imagine that it could, but I also can imagine a path by which you and others are able to support the institutions and the boards in their work of continuing these alignment efforts that might not require legislation.
Madam Chair.
Also need to be mindful of the agreement between Mount Hood Community College, Clackamas Community College, Chemeketa Community College, and Portland State on that very alignment issue, which is new in the last few months and a great model that needs to be extended. And I know Representative Gelzer, Representative Farr, and Representative Dahlem. Oh, we're just shooting your time frame all to pieces, aren't we? Oh, I'm sorry. And Representative Morgan. Sorry, she was on my list first. I apologize. Representative Morgan.
And I think just to continue along the vein that the speaker is in, that over the last interim and then into the last session, the Board of Higher Ed has, I think, been working very hard with the community college system to try to smooth some of those transitions. And the investment that the legislature made in two separate information systems to help the college or the high school information get into the college system and then help the information move around within the community college's higher ed system. Both of those are going to play real well into trying to blur the line between the last 2 years of high school and the college credit piece of the community college system and then the first 2 years of the four-year system. And I think that there has been a tremendous amount of work to do. There's also a lot of dual enrollment agreements that are now on the books that weren't on the books before, so that students that are in community colleges are simultaneously enrolled in a four-year institution and have a really clear idea of how their credits are going to transfer across. But I think in the bigger picture, you've got an education system that is on a 50s and 60s model of what students are like.
Would that be 1850 and 1860?
A lot of non-traditional students and students that are coming and going in the system and transferring through the system geographically a lot, and the system isn't built to do that, and so we're to reform it over time so that it works better for the kind of students that are in the system now is something that we do need to keep hammering away on. And I think that we do need to be looking at how to help facilitate those discussions, because I think that Jill was real clear that you've got people that are real protective of their turf. They all think that their institution has a little bit of an edge that makes it better and different from every other institution, and they want to protect their individual identities. And so we're telling them something quite different from that right now, that we want more commonality in the system. And we need to look at things like performance standards that we can put in place that'll move the system in that direction.
You can tell Representative Morgan read her homework.
Yes, she did. And got an A, by the way.
Representative Gelzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is more of a comment. I represent Benton County, and we're fortunate to have Oregon State University and Lynn Benton Community College. And I think that those institutions, along with the Philomath School District and the Corvallis School District, really are providing some leadership in how well this can work. We've got high school students in my district that aren't just dual enrolled with the community college. They're triple enrolled, where they bounce through. They're taking courses as high school students at the community college. they find something else that they need at the university. And when I talked to President Ray about how is it that they worked this out when there's all this discussion going all over the place and all of the risk, he said that the leaders of the school districts, the community college, and the university got together. They meet regularly and are willing to take those risks around their funding and around their turf, and they follow the kids. They try to see where those innovative and non-traditional kids are bouncing, and then they knock the barriers out of their way to make it possible for these kids to access the educational opportunities that they're telling the educational systems that they need. And what I'm wondering is if there's any data that's coming out of that part of the state to show whether or not that is improving the length of time it takes for some of these students to move through to a four-year degree, starting with those that began taking college courses in high school, and then also those that are able to address that capacity problem of course slots at the community college and even at Oregon State for core classes by taking advantage of finding that class wherever they can so that it fits either in their work schedule so that they can cope with that increasing tuition or just seats in the classroom.
I think that's a great question. We haven't looked at those individual partnerships and dug down into those data, but they probably have been in place long enough now so that there is some longitudinal data that we could look at, and we'll do that. I think that's a great idea. And another thing I think that is valuable about your comment is that it really does demonstrate that while what you will see from us is a recommendation for a very large structural change, it is being modeled in many ways already. We already know that it can work and it can be done. What we would like to do is to remove the amount of effort and time and energy, as was mentioned before this particular meeting began, that administrators have to expend in order to go around the policy and structural barriers that exist to make those kinds of things happen.
A quick follow-up?
Quick follow-up.
I think that the last thing that all of the administrators in these groups shared with me was the unintended benefits that they've reaped from this. So it's beyond the students moving through, but increasing opportunities for education in the K-12 system, counseling interns coming in and providing those counseling programs where we've got decreasing math scores, getting out kind of outside of that student teaching program, bringing them in where there's a lack of facilities, having all of those institutions share physical facilities so that expands opportunity for kids.
Well, what they've essentially done is to design around the needs of the student,
right,
rather than around the needs of the institution, and that's a huge change, and it works.
And a noted recommendation here. Representative Farr.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Well, I might say that the University of Oregon and Lane Community College in Eugene have been working cooperatively for many years and do a great job with the dual enrollment program. And I was at a press conference early this year with President Ray and President Mary Spilde of Lane Community College announcing the same collaboration, because really what it's all about are students and helping them be successful. But that isn't what my question is. That was strictly a comment.
this
is the danger of this is the danger when you have to wait so long to ask your question. So I'm going to back up just a little bit. But I read an article recently that talked about high school students' readiness for college, and I wondered if what it said was high schools are not preparing students when they graduate to do college level work. So of course we know a lot of students drop out of college, but I just wondered if there's a correlation between the increased percentage of students who take longer to finish for a degree and that college preparedness.
Yes, there is. There is a sort of a little known, but I think a very large remediation cycle that is in play between a student leaving a K-12 system and fully entering a post-secondary system ready to do that level of work. Mm-hmm. That kind of remediation typically happens in the community colleges because it's less expensive for the student to do, but that contributes enormously to the amount of time it takes for the student to achieve the eventual goal. It adds to the cost both of the student and the student's family and of the public dollars involved, and it takes up capacity, system capacity, so that it makes it harder then for more students to get in and get through, because there's this sort of churn happening in the center. It's a very big issue, and it's one of the things that we're wanting to address with these recommendations for you?
A direct question, Representative Dahlem.
I'm going to wrap up, I think, what I've heard at the table from several people. One is anecdotal evidence, and I don't doubt it one bit. Being the superintendent at Central Lynn, the cooperation between the community college, Lynn Benton, and Oregon State was phenomenal. It did not come without grinding and hard work. But I had lunch some time ago with a very highly placed executive in the university system, and he explained exactly what Representative Morgan was talking about and what Speaker Menace was talking about. We do have anecdotal places where there is cooperation. But we have a lot of places where there is turf protecting and where the players at the table are presently protecting their position because they have a position of influence, and to cooperate, they would lose some influence. So I'm going to ask you a direct question. I'm going back to the speaker's request. Would you recommend to this panel that we get in there and muck around in what a credit is and what should be applied for? Or should we give the universities one more shot at that? When should we act? When should we take the ball? When should we tell them what to do? Or should we?
Well, we'll get to the role of the legislature towards the end. The biggest point I would make at this stage, and we will want to come back to the recommendations, is the conversations you're having here need to happen regularly with the systems, and you need to review system performance on a continuous. The kinds of conversation that we're having need to happen in a organized way with the systems, and then you identify what are the barriers. I mean, you can take the examples where things are working well and ask them what they need from you to do better. So, I mean, Ed Ray would be a great example. Ask him, as we've asked him from the board level, what would it take for you to be even more successful from the state? I think there's a positive way to go at this, and where you see people digging in, looking at, you know, the tools you might have to create incentives or penalties for those who aren't. And that's without getting into, you know, do you need to muck around? Yes, you do, in the sense of you need to understand how the system's performing, and it's not just a one-time deal. It's every session, thinking about every stage of the system. Are we making improvements? Is it getting better? And what do we need to do next to support its improvement? Some cases it'll be supportive actions. Some cases it'll be changes. But that's the kind of change process we're imagining.
Yeah, and I would add to that that I think it's reasonable to remember that there isn't anyone, I would guess, in these systems who is being obstructive on purpose or who doesn't want students to be well educated. People are behaving rationally based on how the systems are structured and how the policies are put in place. So the job, I think, that you have is to take a look at those structures and policies and see if they are incenting the kinds of behaviors that result in good outcomes for students. And our assumption here that we have developed is that they are not. And they are, and on the screen are some reasons. We've got, if you count the pre-K system, we've got four entirely separate sectors: pre-K, K-12, community college, university system. They're all budgeted separately. They're governed separately. They have different goals in mind. There aren't consistent exit and entrance standards, so it's difficult, as we have discussed, for students to make transitions. And we tend to see those systems organized more by time and by institution than by what achievements students have made and what options they need and want to have for their futures. So essentially, what we're looking at is pernicious success. We have a system that's doing precisely what it is designed to do. And it was designed some many decades ago at a point in time when we did not have an economy or a culture or a technology that expected a large number of students to move to high levels of education attainment. Didn't want that, didn't need that. That is the design with which you are struggling and with which the administrators of these systems are struggling. And so these obstacles and these things that look like very bad behavior aren't bad behavior. There are rational responses to what they've got to work with. And there is, I think, a limit to how far you can put patches, no matter how much goodwill is intended, on those systems to get to the levels of education attainment that we earlier suggested would be very valuable to the citizens of Oregon. So it might be time to design a system that really reflects this current reality and the future needs that we can project.
Jill, how have we disrupted your timeline? Are we way behind for you?
Oh, about an hour.
No. Representative Robin has a direct question.
No, that's just fine.
And Representative Minnis has a direct comment.
Mine was really a direct comment. And I think what this has shown in this conversation is that we don't have a system. I mean, it's clear that a kid in Coos Bay or in Baker City doesn't have access to what we heard from some of these other people because their community colleges have worked something out with particular schools. That is wrong in its very essence as a state system. And so I guess the thing that I'm saying is that we go back to what we said in the first, and that is that we have to have standards that everybody's agreed to, and an assessment system that says this student has passed this calculus class, whether it's in Baker City or Coos Bay, and every school that is a state school is going to accept that calculus class, and the student will perform. Because that's the problem that schools have gotten into at the university level. They have accepted credits, and then they put the student in the next pace, and they can't perform because they haven't met the standard or the achievement level that they need to. And so, as a system, if we don't get to the point where the calculus class is being taken in this school or the advanced English class is being taken in this other school, meet the same, give them the benefits and the achievement levels for that student to be successful at the next level, then we aren't doing our job. And that's the issue that I think we all have to come to grips with, because I don't want a kid in Baker City to be at a disadvantage to a person that's in Corvallis because where he grew up, when it's our education system.
We need to be having more conversations, don't we?
We do.
Representative Minnis.
And the reason I brought this all up, you know, Dennis Sluk, I think you probably remember him when he served here, and I think it was the early 90s. He began this discussion about articulation back all of those years ago, and as I recall, when he went home, they said, don't worry about it, Representative. We've got it handled. We're going to work this out. We're going to talk. So here we are many years later, and we're still talking. So I think it's always good to talk, and I'm encouraged by some of the things I've heard this morning, but we want to know what is the best course as lawmakers,
right,
to help facilitate making sure that our young people are getting education and we remove as many barriers to that as we possibly can.
Well, we're going to give you some ideas about that, I promise you.
Right. If you let us, right?
This is wonderful.
We appreciate you having
this. This is wonderful.
Because this is really what we were hoping to stimulate.
We'll settle them down.
No, no, no. No, raise the ruckus. So we'd like for Oregon to be the first state that really could govern, budget, manage, and deliver education across the whole continuum, preschool to graduate and professional degrees, dramatically increasing the level of education attainment of Oregon students. We think there are three pieces, very important pieces, that need to be put in place to do that. One of them is to really construct the elements of that education continuum, align those levels so that when you leave one, you're ready to enter the next one, whether that's from fifth to sixth grade or from 12th grade to post-secondary. That we have a unified and transparent budget so that what we are really buying with public dollars is education experiences for students that are valuable and useful, and we all can see that that's happening, and a data system that is integrated and so powerful that we can carry both student information and institutional information so we know how things are going as we move along. So how are we doing on the agenda? Well, we got through the introduction. I'm so proud and happy. I can hardly tell you. So with that, we're gonna talk now about these three pieces, and to Speaker Minnis's point, I think get into some things that you might want to be thinking about sinking your teeth into, and we'll start with this notion of the delivery continuum. Just in very rapid overview, what that is in our minds is a unified delivery system that aligns curriculum so that when you leave one place, you're ready to enter the next. Students move toward proficiency, as Representative Dallin describes, and Representative Roblin, at their best pace. So if it's a student who can do this really well, they move fast, they get college credits early, all of that sort of thing. And if it's me and a slow learner, then I get as much time as I need to learn whatever this thing is. Instruction is really personalized. The student is known and is the center of the instruction. The student is not just furniture in the room. And that as students get older and as they move through this continuum, the options that they need are there. There are increased choices for them. And that fundamentally we have education systems that really will support acceleration. Our belief is that students could go a lot faster than they are going if we supported them in doing that. And there is probably no one better than Karen Phillips, who is, as you have already learned, director of the Small Schools Initiative for E3, to give you some information that's real and from the field about how some of this looks. Karen?
Thank you, Jill. Good morning, and again, thank you for allowing us this time this morning. As Duncan mentioned, I've worked in the North Clackamas school system, in North Clackamas and in Malala, large system, small system, for over 20 years in high school. High school teacher, mathematics, vice principal, student management, curriculum, and also director of student secondary programs across the district. In that work, and I share that background because I think it brought me to where I am today working with OBC and E3, also was leading the work when North Clackamas was changing their graduation requirements, and as a large district, asking these very same questions: what should we be expecting of all our students, and what does it take within the system to get them there? And if you've been watching North Clackamas over the last 3 years, when they put in the graduation requirements that have exit standards and their board stood firm, students rose to that occasion and their dropout rate has not risen. So there's an example of a school district who said, we believe all students can learn. It's up to us to find out how to provide the supports, and they're doing that. What I bring to you today is a picture of where Oregon is in their field experience in the Oregon Small Schools Initiative. And I'm going to share a very brief picture of the national research around this small school model, because the national research is 10 to 15 years old, and the Oregon work is only 2 years old in our schools. So I just need to share with you, I do have some early indicators of success data from the schools, but it's early. And this work is very complex, and it takes 5 to 10 years. I'll share with you some national research, some field research in Oregon, and then some ideas in terms of policy implications. Just a step back for a moment, that E3, as Duncan mentioned, is an affiliate of the Oregon Business Council. It's a nonprofit formed in 1996, and it's committed to dramatically improving student achievement by bringing communities, business partners, and educators together around these topics about what we need to do to change our schools. It has three major projects. The Oregon Small Schools Initiative is the largest. Partnership for Student Success is a project working with 12 to 14 school districts, and that's educators and business partners together choosing a goal specifically tied to literacy and student achievement, and then working together to improve that. And then the Employer Classroom Connection, which is a recognition and a recruitment of businesses working with schools. I want to share something from the American Diploma Project, of which Oregon is one of 22 states working with the American Diploma Project, whose goal, as we've been discussing in this room, is to graduate all students with the knowledge and skills they need to succeed in post-secondary learning and work in the 21st century. So this is not just unique to Oregon, what we're grappling here. This is a challenge across the nation, all these questions you've been asking. The good news is that 22 states have stepped forward, more are coming forward, and they're working together, sharing some best practices among those states that are beginning to work, and I'm going to share a few of those as I move forward.
I do want to start by telling you what we do know about the small school model. The small school model is just one strategy to improve our high schools. There are others that work. I feel very passionately about the small school model. I've been to some of the national model schools across the United States that have been in existence for over 10 years and continually have high student achievement, which I'm going to show you in just a moment exactly what high means. So I've seen it with my own two eyes, and that makes a believer out of me. There are other strategies. Every school in Oregon doesn't have to become small to do what I'm going to share with you, but I believe that what we're doing in this project is going to generate some learnings and some strategies that can be applied to every high school in Oregon, all 240-some public high schools. So they may not all be small in 10 years from now, but I think they should have some of the strategies that we're beginning to see that work.
Karen, so before you go, we have a question to insert.
Sure, thank you. Just a quick, what's the definition of small school?
Thank you. The national research says there's somewhere between 300 and 600 seems to be a number that leads to higher student achievement. We're finding more research, and it's a number we ended up with, that it's 400 or less.
For high school?
That's for high school. And currently in Oregon, 49% of our public high schools are already 400 or less. Not every one of those high schools is high achieving, so small in itself is not a magic bullet.
Representative Minnis?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rounds High School is a large high school, but what they have done is made small schools within a large school.
Absolutely.
Can you comment on that program and see, maybe let us know how you believe that works? Steve Olzak, who implemented that, has now gone to Portland Public Schools.
Right.
Just want to know your thoughts. If you think that's...
I think that's an absolute viable model. And so when I said small schools, and I'm going to describe to you what Marshall and Roosevelt have done, which are our schools in front, are literally small autonomous schools within one campus as autonomous from each other as maybe an elementary school that's 2 miles apart. Reynolds has done something similar in small learning communities, and the difference between a small school that I'm going to be talking about and small learning communities is really the extent of the autonomy amongst the groups of students and teachers. Let me give you an example in Reynolds. In Reynolds, around 300 to 400 students spend part of their day with a common group of teachers, usually social studies, English, science. And that's true of Southridge and some other schools in Oregon. The rest of their day, they're out moving amongst the entire high school campus and spread of high school teachers. So they're putting in place at Reynolds in small learning communities a number of the attributes I'm going to share that you need in place if you're going to have a high-achieving system. So my comment to you is that Reynolds is an example of a school that's taking significant changes, building on the research that's come out of the small schools, and has an opportunity to move forward in what they do with students. The research shows us, and it's from about the early 90s through, it's currently going on 2006, that in small high schools overall, again, using that number of between less than 600 and most of them less than 400, what we find in comparing it to large high schools across the United States is higher student achievement, more students graduating, of those more going on to college, the very goals that we're talking about in this room today, less violence. And when you think about the shootings that were happening in the 90s and the early 2000s, that was very important to us, and it is today. The conditions of the smallness better support student learning and teacher development. And I know when Chalkboard was sharing with you a month ago, one of their goals is that we need to have effective and highly qualified teachers in all of our classrooms, and that means more professional development. In those small schools, parents in the community are more satisfied with what their schools are doing, and the cost per graduate are less, and that's something I think as state government we need to be concerned with. I do want to just briefly put this in front of you, that there is a body of research around high schools in particular
that says the small and the attributes of a good small high school can make a difference, and I just list a few of those for you. I'll mention three of them that I am most from. Well, actually, I've read all of these, but three of them that I return to most often is the very recent one, January 2006, a report on the Boston Pilot Schools. Boston Pilot Schools are a body of schools very similar to what we're doing. They've been 10 years in existence. This report is about the student achievement from those 10 years as compared to the rest of the Boston school district, and all of those attributes that I just showed you, higher student achievement, more students graduating, less violence, all of those have proven out in those schools in the Boston Pilot study. So recent research out there that says this does work.
We have a question. Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back to the last slide, can you expand on cost? How do you, what's the, convince me.
The cost per graduate in particular, this came out of the study from Dollars and Cents, and they were looking at small schools and large schools, taking literally the expenses of a school district or school high school, dividing it by the number of students, and what does it cost. There are cases when small schools can cost more dollar for dollar for students, but we lose more students if we're in a system that's not structured properly, in particular in high school. The cost, if you look at the fact that small high schools are graduating more students, and you take the graduates and divide it by the cost, you're getting a better outcome for the amount of dollars that's going in. So there can be some costs higher in a small school, but it doesn't necessarily have to be there. And there was a follow-up study comparing large and small high schools in Seattle District and in Denver District. And what they found was it's not the size of the school, because they found very expensive small schools and very cost-efficient large schools. It was how the school system was set up and how we're using our dollars, which I think is what Chalkboard was here talking to you about.
Follow-up?
Thank you. To me, the cost is going to be driven by the size of the class and the number of days of school. So, I mean,
the cost in terms of bottom line expense of the system. What I'm saying to you is, if you're not graduating all
the student, not the operating cost.
That's right. If you're not graduating all the students, if you were making widgets, but 40% of them were going in the recycle bin, then it doesn't matter if the expenses you're putting in are the same as the system that's turning out 90% of their good widgets. Kids are not widgets, but if we're looking at just revenues, we need to look, I think, at graduates. Or is the system working, and then what does it cost us to get there?
Will you be addressing, Karen, the Lebanon situation, which was a conversion and which has been apparently
They're still moving
modified.
Forward. We are not currently working with them. And I'd like to share with you a few schools that opened, and then I will make sure I do Lebanon or remind
Great.
Me to put it in that context. As I mentioned, we are working with American Diploma Project. When I said high schools have higher student achievement if they're small schools with the attributes, I just want to share quickly with you two specific schools. These are not Oregon schools. As I said, our schools are new. These are schools that have been in existence for 10 years. They do happen to both be in New York City, and I know New York is not Oregon. But I share these two specific models for a very important reason. The research that we're seeing and what works is not about high-income, two-parent family, students who come to us and could learn in spite of us, and yes, the systems work. The research that we're looking at is saying all students, in particular, the underrepresented, underachieving, and underserved students of the past, low-income or students of color, for instance, are in particular succeeding at these schools, as well as the high-achieving student. For instance, International High School at LaGuardia, 100% of the students at that school have been in the United States 4 years or less. 100%. They speak more than 56 different languages at that school. They have a 95% graduation rate, and of those students, 94% of them, when they graduate, are accepted from college. It's an example of this can be done if we set our system up. And that is also an example of the systems working together, as Representative Gelzer was talking about. This is located at LaGuardia Community College, and the community college and the high school together have set the system up and own the children. I share Urban Academy. That is an example of one small school in a large school that used to be one high school. It now has six small schools on that campus. This particular school, if you take a look at their suspension rate, zero students, and that they stay close to zero. When they began their work on small schools, the nickname of Julia Richmond was Julia Reichert, after Reichert Prison, because that school was in such disarray and had so much violence. That was the joke around town if you went there. That was the type of environment you were in. Through the small schools model and the attributes of small schools, there's some other things you need to do than just saying a small amount of students, teachers working together. They have totally turned the school around, and the graduation rate stays close over the last 10 years to 100% of students, and the college acceptance rate stays between 95 to 100%.
What was the population at that Urban Academy? Was
that Urban Academy is 70% African American and Latino, 75% eligible for Medicaid.
And the number of students in
Julia Academy is 120, and the other schools are close to that size. And there's I guess they're between 120 and 300, and there's six schools on campus, so it's less than 1,000 students on the campus now.
Representative Roblin, Representative Dahlem.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to go back to the previous guy and follow along with Representative Wisner. If we went to Oregon, a model where all of the schools in the state were small schools, so not just the 47% that are now, but all of them, the total cost to the, not per student, but the total cost for the system would increase.
Yes.
Do we know approximately how much it would cost?
In the dollars and cents research, and I do have that so I could refer to it, they actually came up with a number of how much more per student, and I certainly could share that with you. I do want to share that I don't think it's as simple as that.
I agree.
In the follow-up study, which was intriguing to me when they compared large and small schools in Seattle and large and small schools in Denver, they took a more detailed look at the expenses. How we spend on transportation from district to district varies widely. Again, I think some work that Chalkboard recently looked at, how we spend some dollars within the system. Small schools can cost more. I do want to share that the 46 schools that Duncan is talking about that we're opening either within large high schools or magnets and charters are all public schools in Oregon operating with the current revenues that we have in the system. So you can do this with the current revenues. Our grant dollars help with the professional development and the planning that it takes to change the system, and that may be the cost that we need to struggle with. How do we do that?
Okay. Got a question answered? Thank you.
This slide, and then I want to go on to what our project is doing, but I do want to share, as I said, small is not an answer unto itself. If that was simple, then every one of our 49% of the small high schools in Oregon would be our highest achieving, and they're not, although some of them are. When we were starting early in the work of the initiative, we took a look at, I believe this data is 2000-2001, all of the high schools in Oregon, and we separated them at that time by schools 800 students or greater, 800 students or less, and we took the three state assessments in reading, math, and writing, and we took a look at the number of students in Oregon in those schools proficient on those state tests, and gave each school an average. How were they doing on those state tests? And each one of these dots on this chart in front of you represents a school in Oregon and that average. And so the horizontal axis is the percent of free and reduced lunch, or the low-income school. So as you're moving to the right, on the horizontal axis, you're looking at schools that have more students in poverty. As you're looking at the vertical axis, it's showing you the amount of students proficient on the state tests at that school. what we found, not a surprise to any of you in this room or in the national research, is that as a school has a higher population of students in poverty, its achievement on average goes down. That wasn't a surprise to us, but if you, we were working with a statistician who put in a line of best fit. The red dots and the red line are schools greater than 800. And notice how steep the line is. As we get poorer in the schools, the achievement drops off rapidly. If you look at the green line, which is schools less than 800, it also drops off as the schools are getting poorer, but it drops off much less steeply. So what this says to us is if we changed nothing else, small does negate the effect of poverty better than large does. What I would argue is taking that smallness and putting in some other changes within the system, which I'm going to share with you, could create the achievement to go up even more than what you see here. So this is just an example. We're not New York. We are Oregon, but this is Oregon data. And small in itself does help us address the issue of low-income students in Oregon, and we have a lot of poor students in Oregon. This is an issue for us.
Representative Lavakian has a question for
you. Thank you, Madam Chair. When you're talking about smaller schools, are we to assume that that means smaller class sizes within the smaller school?
Not necessarily.
What's the effect, then, of having a smaller number of total, smaller total population, if the class sizes are about the same, that is giving you the effect that we see on the graph?
I can only share a hypothesis, because the research in smallness alone, I can't give you facts or a theory, but with less students, and this is the effect we do see in the schools that we're creating, simply less overall, as a let's take the half of Oregon schools, 400 or less. Regardless of whether I have 20, 35, or 40 students in my English class, the amount of students that I see over 4 years and need to know deeply can never be larger than the total amount in the school.
Does it then go, Madam Chairman?
Follow up.
Does it then go back to a relationship that's being built between the teacher and the student?
Absolutely. That's the foundation of why this works. And I would add the family. It's not just a relationship with the student, it's with the family over time.
One other push call here.
Would that relationship extend also to the counselor, the vice principal, any other staff, the custodian?
I
you become more of a family?
The entire school does. In fact, relationships, I think, are the foundation of how we're going to change the system. I'm going to go back to what Representative Gelzer was talking about. We had three different institutions and organizations working together. The reason that worked, regardless of policy or in spite of policy, is because of the relationships that they were sharing. It's that same idea that as we begin to develop those relationships where we all own the students together, it's not about your power or status or program, but it's about what are we going to do for these students. That's how we're going to solve this, by then making decisions based on what are the students need us to do.
Thank you.
Representative Barr.
Just a quick question. Recently, North Eugene High School in Eugene started the small schools program, and I think you and I talked on the phone about that, I remember. But I just had a question regarding the competitive nature of a group of small high schools within a high school. Do you think that these high schools and the students that attend them feel a sense of competition for achievement, and that gives them more of a sense of pride in what they accomplish?
It's early for the likes of North Eugene and several of our other schools, because they've been open a week as those small schools. But
I wasn't specifically referring to that.
I understand that. So I don't want to give you an Oregon answer just yet. However, the schools we've visited across the nation, the conversion schools, the large high schools that have several schools in them, I haven't seen a competitive in terms of student achievement But I think it's because they need to attend to the fact that we do all exist in the same building. That we work with two different types of schools, startups, magnets and charters that exist in their own building and they're brand new schools within a school district, and then these conversions where we work with a school like North Eugene, which is in the same campus, same students, same teachers, but three small schools functioning autonomously. Those three small schools need to recognize that we are all together under a campus and continue to work together in some fashions different than a magnet school or an elementary school in Eugene that's one's downtown and the other one's 2 miles away. I mean, they clearly can do things very autonomous, different than when I'm sharing a hallway with you, I'm sharing a cafeteria, a gym. So I think the important point is a conversion is that we pay attention to that they're built on the small school research, but they're different, and they need to pay attention to that, and we work directly with our schools to help them do that.
That's a very important point. Could I follow up?
May Representative Abbasi follow up, please?
Well, I asked you, Madam Chair.
You may.
I think what you just said is theoretically an incredibly important point. It sounds like what you're saying is instead of instilling a competitive nature where one will do better than the other, you want to create an educational environment where every single one of them succeeds.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, we work directly with our schools. We have a coach, one of our staff members, with each one of our schools. But I'll give you, for instance, with Roosevelt, who has been in the small schools for 3 years. They have three small schools, what used to be the large Roosevelt campus. And they did, in their initial year, they allowed, there's different ways of assigning students who were in the Roosevelt campus to the individual small schools. Allowed total student choice, so students got their first choice of which school speaks most to you. And they had varying levels of the demographics in those schools, because you wouldn't want to take a school such as Roosevelt that has a large population of Caucasian students, Latino students, and African American students, and create three schools where one's white, one's Latino, and one's African-American. And in their first year of existence, they had some imbalance that wasn't quite where they wanted it to be. Working together with them, adjusting some, I'll call it recruitment and marketing efforts. How do you explain your school to students in such a way that all students across all cultures and achievements are interested? They begin to balance who's in those different schools. So we intentionally work on the three schools have the same high standards, they have the same expectations, as Marshall says all the time to their three schools, and they say it to the parents, it really doesn't matter which one of the three schools you're in, they're all college prep. We can guarantee that any one school you're in, you graduate ready for college. And that's the standard we use with all of our schools. So it's not a high-achieving school, and then that's where you go if you're a low-achieving or you have set your standards less.
So
but you have to be intentional.
We're using standards now, especially under the No Child Left Behind Act, which forces students into or schools into categories where some are identified as excelling and others are identified as being on the losing end of that.
Well,
scale.
And remember that Roosevelt and Marshall were labeled under No Child Left Behind as failing schools. And I'm going to show you some data. I would argue that in them taking into their own hands that they were going to change their school system, they have. Marshall, for the last 2 years that they've been under the small school model, for the first year since 1998, right, is gaining enrollment, not losing it. So No Child Left Behind may say failing. They're turning their school around.
And they are turning their school around, which is a positive. But you've also pressed a passion button for Representative Representative Bollum.
Let me press it some more. Would No Child Left Behind then be the catalyst that fired the crucible that brought the change?
Well, thank you for asking that question. We're working with 10 conversion schools. It was Lebanon. It was 11, including Lebanon. Two of those schools, just two, happened to be labeled failing under No Child Left Behind. The other schools had varying levels of how they were doing. I'll use an example from North Eugene. If you looked at North Eugene's student assessment data and their graduation rate, they're at least at state average, if not better. I mean, if you looked at the school as a whole, no one would label North Eugene failing or be worried about sending their student there. So when talking to the school, so why are you doing this? When they disaggregated their data, and that's where we really work with our schools. Who are you serving and who aren't you serving? This is about all children, high standards, not some, which is what our model is built on. I mean, it's not anyone's fault. It's what we needed in 1920. It's not what we need in 2006. When they disaggregated their data, it was clear who they were not serving, and that's what most of our 10 schools are doing at the table, saying it's not okay to say, well, your 5 students aren't going to get what everyone else does, I'm sorry, but we're doing 95%, so we're okay. But you're the 5%, we're going to say, it's good enough. We're saying it's not okay to look anyone in the eye and say that. And that's the issue that I think we need to work with all of Oregon on. Averages are not okay.
Representative Roblin.
Quick comment again, and it goes back to the competition issue. If you go back to Myers' work in New York, which is kind of the foundation of a lot of small school stuff, it was definitely not competition. It was the idea that every individual student needed to get there. So I appreciate that.
Thank you for bringing that up. The last thing in the world we'd want to create is the haves and the have-nots. The Small Schools Initiative, as you can hear from my passion, our mission is to create high-achieving, equitable small high schools. And we define equity not as equal access, which is, I think, an old definition. It's equal outcomes.
Right.
Who's achieving at your school should not be predicted by race, culture, ethnicity, language, socioeconomic status. And our goals, just as the goal of this committee, are close the achievement gap, increase the graduation rate, and increase the number of students ready for college, work, and citizenship. We use 3 major strategies. We're reconfiguring large high schools, the Marshalls, the Roosevelts, the North Eugenes. We create new innovative small high schools. We just had 2 open up, one in Springfield, a district arts magnet, and one in Portland, a charter high school for leadership and entrepreneurship. But we're currently working with 8 small schools. And then we have another part of our work that's a little bit quieter, but also the reason that I'm here in this room, is that we believe our work with those real schools as demonstration sites will be a catalyst to change teaching and learning across Oregon, whether or not they're specifically in the small school structure. For every one of our schools, we do not tell them what the design needs to be like. So in Eugene, we have an innovation school, we have an international school, and we have an arts school. That's their choice. We do say that any school that works with us needs to have these 5 agreements at the core of what they do. Every decision they make, their student handbook, how they set up their schedule, who gets into which classes, it's about equity and social justice. And that aligns with what Chalkboard Project was saying, is we need to create safe and respectful environments in Oregon schools. We also need to engage the community so that it authors the vision. We're talking about significantly changing the structure of high school as we know it today. Our communities will not automatically come to say that's a good thing to do. We all went through high school. We have a picture in our head of what that should be and what it should be for our students. And as we're talking in this room today, that model probably needs to change, because high school was created for a different world than what it's doing now. So we have to have the community at the table, business partners, parents, as we design what these new small schools look like. In terms of the Lebanon model, what we had announced to the public, and I will say to you, is that there were 2 major issues that brought us to the point where we said we can no longer continue to work with you, because there are some things that need to happen before you're going to be able to successfully put this model in place. One was that there was fragmented leadership from the different points of the community, the board, the superintendent, and the building. If all your leadership is not working on the same vision and moving together, you'll never be able to make these significant changes and decisions you're going to need to make. And the other is that they didn't have a plan that the leadership could then take and move forward. And part of that plan had to be engaging their community. And if you read any of the press around what was happening in Lebanon, they had not engaged the entire community, both in the school, teachers, students, and administrators, and outside of the school, before they made the jump into small schools. Mm. And so what happens is you make the jumps and put the structures in place and things look different, and you haven't told anyone what you're doing or got their feedback on it before you did that. So they feel like you've taken something away. So in our schools, we say you've got to have the community at the table from day one before you make this decision.
Karen, just as a sidebar here, and I would like to have a follow-up conversation with you. A couple of red flags have just come up for me on your first goal, pursuing equity and social justice, and advocating social justice and equity is a definition that has come under some controversy. So I would like to follow up with you on that.
Okay.
Madam
Chair. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, since you've taken a break. I won't take the committee's time, but Karen, I would appreciate either paperwork or meeting between us of how long Mr. Gates is going to be able to support this, mm-hmm. how you're spending your money, the role of the governor, the role of superintendent of education, Department of Education, and your decisions, and how do other schools get to play, or how do you make your decisions on the expenditure of Mr. Gates' funds?
Great. And I'll follow up on that.
And as we, and to all of you presenters, all of these questions that we've asked for feedback on, if you'll channel them through Mr. Keller so he can distribute to us, and also perhaps I hope it's possible that you'll provide us a copy of your wonderful PowerPoint to Mr. Keller.
Okay. Since Duncan Wise was taking notes as you were going through your list, is it all right with you if I add to that the one body in the land that's in charge of funding public education, what their role might be? Representative Wisnett added the governor's office and the state school superintendent. I think they've been partners. maybe those that fund it should be on the list as well.
Next.
I would be leaving something important out if I didn't say one of the most important things that these schools do in addition to small, and this is what any school could do, is that all of your systems, your schedules, how you staff, how you put students in classes, the curriculum you teach, have to be built on academic rigor, and then we need to create a definition of that. I think that's part of what our conversation was this morning. It has to be for all students. This is what Duncan was talking about, that the State Board is looking at, that it's higher standards that are clear for all students, that I can't make a wrong choice as I go through your high school system, so that when I walk out the door, I'm prepared for whatever my future is. We should not have the high school systems making the decision that Jill will go on to post-high school education, but Duncan will decide for him as a system that he won't. And our current system is set up to track in that fashion. We've all got to walk out the door with all the skills we need, and then it's our choice where we go from there. The relevance is something that Reynolds, for instance, is a great example of what they're doing. If students don't have positive relationships with an adult they know knows them and cares about them and uses that to inform their instruction and sees the relevance of education, we will not be able to motivate them to move to those high standards. We can't just raise the bar and say, jump over it because I say to. But we need to raise the bar because that's the skills they need. And then on the foundation of positive relationships and relevant curriculum, students give us, I'm going to quote another director from another state, the moral authority to push them to those rigorous standards. And that's when you see that data that came out of Urban Academy and International High School. All kids can do this. They just need the motivation and the support to get there.
I'm excited. Oh, dang it. Representative Gelzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You've mentioned some of the subgroups that have done better in these small schools, including kids in poverty and kids of color. What about students with disabilities, including those with mental retardation? Are they included in these small schools? Are the supports there for them, and is their achievement improving?
Yes. All students are included in this, special education students, students with disabilities included. Students with severe cognitive disabilities that may be in what we call a life skills class may not always be in these classes necessarily. However, how we set up our schools is to say this is about inclusion and to taking each and every student personalized. And again, that's part of the board's plan. If you have a personalized plan and the support, to take it as far as you can go. So the schools I've looked at the data and visited them, they have a total inclusion model, not pullouts. And those students are achieving at very high levels. And I can share individual student names and stories of special education students I've talked with some incredible achievement and going on to college. Thank you. Thank you for asking that question. Briefly pointing you to the map, just so you have a sense of where we're working. This particular map shows both programs of E3, the Partnership for Student Success and the Oregon Small Schools Initiative. But the blue dots show you where we either have a large high school we're working with or a small school that's either open or in the design stage of being open. So we're as far east as Pendleton. Nikiawi Community Charter School is on the Umatilla Confederated Tribes Indian Reservation, has 64 students in it, and they are in their third year of existence. As far south as Medford and Central Point, we have both Medford High Schools working with us, and Central Point High School is working with us. And then, as you can see, many schools up and down the I-5 corridor, and then we did not have anyone recently until this last round when we chose schools in the center of the state. We were working with Madras School District, and we'll be opening next September a small school there, and we're thrilled to be working with Madras, in particular because their population is so unique. They're almost exactly one-third Caucasian, one-third American, Native American, and one-third Latino. And we're working to open a small high school to really be a catalyst for change across the whole district to, again, show with the right conditions all students can achieve. So it gives you a sense of the different places where we are. And it's been important to us to be a statewide initiative. If we were only working in Portland, as you know, Oregon is very diverse. And a school in Baker City or a school in Jordan Valley would look at the learnings from Portland and say, what does that have to do with my school and my community? We wanted to be in enough diverse places that every school in Oregon could say, well, maybe I don't think I can learn from Marshall High School, but Madras is a lot like me, rural, small community. If they could do this, maybe I could too. So that spread has been important to us. A picture of where we are, again, in terms of the diversity, this is not all the districts. We're working on 18 different campuses, large or small schools, and 14 different districts. So this is just some of the districts we're in. If you look at that first column, you'll see that our largest district is Portland, 48,000 students district-wide. But then we're in three small districts, Central Point, Newburgh, and Woodburn. Their district is as large as two of some of the larger high schools. Reynolds is one of the largest high schools in Oregon. Again, we wanted to be broadly represented so that different schools could use us as a demonstration sites. And then if it is important that we close the achievement gap, so in order to work with us, schools had to have 25% or greater of students of color and or low-income students to be a school that we're working with. And you'll notice that the results I'm going to show you is not because I chose the easiest schools in Oregon who are already achieving, but we went to schools who had underserved population and were willing to work with us to do things differently for them. Collectively, as Duncan mentioned earlier, when you count the individual small schools in the conversions, so instead of counting Marshall as a school of one, it's a school of three. Eugene would be counted as three. We will have 46 small schools opened by September of next year that didn't exist a year ago, reaching over 14,000 students, which is about a little over 8%. I'm not saying that's critical mass yet, but as we move forward, we could reach critical mass to have enough schools in change that it begins to provide that impetus to move everyone forward. And we've awarded so far over $13 million, primarily used for professional development and planning. It cannot be used for operations. So as you think about what does it cost to do this, we're not touching the operations cost. We already have 11 small schools that were opened, 19 opened just last week. 27 of those in those conversions, like the North Eugene model, three of them were new starts, and we're not quite done. We have some schools still in the planning stage, and we'll have 15 more new schools by next September. So, is it making any difference yet? The work is early. We think it takes 5 to 10 years to truly see the results, but we're collecting data, and the results are promising that we're on the right track. These results are from Marshall campuses at the end of 1 year of small school. As I said, they had increased enrollment. They continue to have more students in the community coming back to the school rather than leaving the school to go to some other Portland High School. In their first year of being in this, they had overall GPA of all students in their school higher than it was before they converted. More students at an even higher level of three-point GPA, and more students achieving in math. At the same time, they had deleted all of their remedial math classes. So when they went to small schools, they only offered algebra and above, and they still increased the number of students achieving. At Liberty High School, it has four small schools. They're more in small learning communities, moving toward that total autonomy of the small school. Number of disciplinary events decreased 14%, and there's a hidden factor there. Liberty just opened in 2003, and it opened without the full 9th through 12th grade continuum. So the year 2004-2005, we were measuring this decrease in disciplinary events. They were growing by an entire class of students. So 300 more students at their school, and yet disciplinary events decreased. Number of students enrolled in advanced placement classes. So again, this is about high standards for all students. In 1 year's time, they increased that by 150%. And they're still working on increasing that more. In fact, speaking of advanced placement, if advanced placement, and I'm not saying it's the only standard for rigor, but it is one standard that's nationally accepted for rigor. If it's good for our top students, isn't it good for all students? And last year, before North Eugene converted, so there's my point that you can make these changes without being in small schools, North Eugene decided if advanced placement English was good for our top kids, it's good for all our kids. They took away their basic English for juniors, regular English for juniors, and took their AP English for juniors. That is their only junior English class. They did that last September. At the same time, they didn't just say the bars here, kids, sink or swim. They trained all of their English teachers in how to teach advanced placement classes. They provided a certified English teacher every period of the day. So if you're getting less than a C, you're automatically in a full period of support in your English classes to succeed. And in doing that, they resulted in, at the end of last year, an 83% passing rate for all students, special education, talented and gifted. Everybody was taking AP English. Now, 83% passing rate, we want better than that. But it was about the same rate it was the year before when they had basic English, regular English, and AP English.
Now, that merits writing, drafting a bill.
It can happen.
I like that.
It can happen. And I think the story that data doesn't tell, so I just have to share this, my last bullet, what this does for students' self-esteem. Students who said, I never even thought of enrolling in an AP class. Not me. That was for those smart kids. I couldn't do that. And then when they're in the class and they say things like, what? I can do this type of work. What else can I do? It totally changed what they believe their future is. And that's what we need to do. One last particular story, South Medford High School, again, before they converted. So any high school could do this. And by the way, South Medford, I think, may be among our largest 10 high schools in the state of Oregon. That's big. 1,700 students. Deleted all remedial classes for freshmen in math and English. Same idea as Eugene. Let's raise the bar. Because if kids are in remedial classes, they never catch up. In doing that, again, you provide support. And they did 20 minutes tutoring daily at lunch, and that's not the punishment it might sound like. They had a 50-minute lunch period. So kids who were failing had to go to 20 minutes tutoring every day, again with a certified teacher. And they closed campus for all freshmen at lunch because freshman was the year they were losing most of their students, which, by the way, is an Oregon, maybe even a national problem. We are losing so many kids freshman year. And deleting all those remedial classes, as you see, resulted in the lowest failure rate of freshmen in math and English in the history of South Medford. Mm. we can do this work. Last story, Roosevelt Campus. If you didn't catch the news article just a week or so ago, these are the end of last year's state assessment results. Roosevelt has been in three small schools for 2 years. There are three small schools. SEIS is a Spanish-English International School. POWER, I always forget these acronyms, Pursuit of Wellness, at Roosevelt, and then the Arts and Communications Technology School. If you look in the column under reading, that is the percentage of students that they increased by who are meeting or exceeding the reading state assessment. The next column tells us how far we still have to go at Roosevelt, because that's how many, even with ACT having a 12% increase, only 36% of their students are meeting that test. However, what all of those pluses and all that grid is telling you is in working in the small schools with these models, higher standards for all students, supports to get there, more students within 2 years are rising to that standard. So we don't have to wait 5 to 10 years to get some results. It will take us longer to meet all students.
Representative Groblin.
I know that you've done some good work also in That last slide indicates two different groups of people. The previous group, the increase, was a different set of kids. And so we haven't really talked about how those individuals increased. And have you done any work that would indicate that might even be higher? Because you don't know.
I couldn't. As a matter of fact, we're going to try to measure that in the years to come. But I couldn't tell you that for Roosevelt, but I could tell you that for Marshall and Jefferson. And we don't happen to be working directly with Jefferson. But Marshall and Jefferson did measure 2003-2004 data. I didn't see their 2004-2005 yet. In measuring where were a cadre of students in eighth grade when they came to us, and where were they 2 years later? And what I can share with you under Marshall's 2 years worth of work is that in the 10 high schools in Portland, the rate of change. Now remember, in Marshall and Roosevelt's in Jefferson, they're coming to us at lower, maybe third grade reading levels, the rate of change was the highest two schools in the entire Portland system. So Lincoln, no offense to them, may be having students that are achieving in the 85 and 90% achievement, but they may have already come to them with 80 and 90% of their students achieving. How far are they growing when they're there? I think it's, as Oregon looks at a measurement of under No Child Left Behind of not just who's achieving, but the individual student growth, I think it's an important question. It tells us more about our schools succeeding. Yeah. Briefly, I've been mentioning it's not just small, but you have to have the right attributes and the right teaching strategies, which is going to take professional development of our teachers in order to get the results we're talking about. So these are just some of the attributes, and this is from national research K-12 of what do schools need to have in common if you really want to take all students to high levels. And then if you'll notice under rigorous curriculum, positive relationships, linking to students' interests. If you look at the Oregon graduation requirements that were changed 4 or 5 years ago and what we're looking at now, it aligns directly with this. So the board leanings is resting on the same research that we're looking at. What we'll need to do additionally, and this may be where the cost comes in, our teachers don't necessarily have all the skills and strategies they need to teach in a way to take all kids to these high standards. Because what kids need to be doing is in-depth learning and then demonstrating, not just on a paper and pencil multiple choice test, but demonstrating in real authentic ways, do I have the skills that it takes to succeed in college and work? So what does that mean for policy? It means we need to focus as leaders, superintendent, governor, state boards, the list goes on instruction and what's happening in the classroom as much as we focus on structure or the day-to-day operations. So we do need policies to guide the operations of schools, the OARs, et cetera. But we also need guidance and expectations in what's happening in instruction to ensure all students get to where they get. We need to find ways to protect schools from outside pressures and barriers while they're moving through this change system. And so we need to help the public that has expectations of the school base their decisions on a 21st century model of high school, not this nostalgic idea of what I thought high school was when I was in school. school needs to look different. Our kids do need different skills. The world in 2006 is not what I found when I graduated and was going in the workforce in the 60s and 70s. You could do just fine with a high school education then. Probably earn more, at least for the first 10 or 20 years, than the person was paying off their college loans. That's not true today, and we have a large contingency in Oregon who doesn't understand that or believe that, and they will block these changes in high schools unless we help them become informed. Secondly, we need to develop a belief in Oregon, and this is not widespread. We need to develop a belief that all means all, students can and should graduate college ready or ready for college work and life. And I'm here to tell you that not everyone in the school system, nor everyone in the public agrees with that. And they will push back if we're expecting high standards of all. And we need to be prepared to lead them through that for Oregon. And then lastly, I've been trying to stay out of saying we need more funding. But I would be remiss if I didn't say, I think we need more funding. This is going to cost if we're going to help schools make these type of changes, and primarily in the planning and in the teacher development. But also, we do have schools in Oregon, as someone mentioned, with classes of 45 in a high school class. If we know that personalization is how we motivate students to high standards, it's not impossible to personalize in a small school, but it's really hard to do that in a class of 45. That's a challenge,
Madam Chair,
that we need to talk about.
Speaker Nunes?
Go ahead. I'll wait.
No, go ahead.
I was going to ask another question on a different subject.
Okay. Very quickly then, and when we talk about all students college ready, taking into account then those that have severe mental or physical limitations and other life issues that would prevent them from going there or even attaining to that level. There is a percentage now in the calculus somewhere that we already consider will not be ready. So how do you...
Thank you. We still want to shoot for 100% because what I would, and I just want to share an individual student story. What I would share is that the percentage of students in Oregon that are severely disabled, cognitively disabled, unable to learn at the levels where they may be able to move into the workforce and have a family wage is a very small percentage. And I want to say I've heard 1%. I don't know if that's accurate or not. So they may not meet this standard, and I don't want to give up on them. However, let me share a story about a special education student. When I was vice principal at Clackamas High School, special education student in a wheelchair, and she had some learning disabilities also, and we knew each other. I saw her several years later when I was no longer working at that high school. I was going back to visit, walking in the front doors. So she was waiting for some friends standing at the front door, and we said, I know you. I recognize you. And we chatted a little bit. What are you doing now, et cetera, et cetera. She says, I'm at Clackamas Community College. She was in her early 20s, talking about how that was going. And she said, you know, I probably shouldn't say this to you, but, you know, I just need to. She said, the advice I was given and the classes I was put in, because I sit in this wheelchair, because I was special education, no one ever told me the choices you were making for me was not preparing me for college. Nobody ever asked me about it. They just assumed. She said, I'm now at college. It's very, very hard. I had so much work to do to bring my skills up. And she said, I'm going to make it. But she said everyone looked at me with the label of special education, sitting in a wheelchair, and they made a decision. They never even had a discussion with me of what I wanted, what I could do, etc. When we talk about special education students, I do realize that there are some students that our goal of 100% may not ever be truly achieved. But as long as we use language that we don't mean all, I find educators and public saying, "Good, then I'm okay where I am."
Yeah.
And we just have to be really careful of what we mean and what expectations we are. The other story I'll share is how many public figures in history have we heard of who some teacher has said, you'll never amount to anything. And they're now, you know, Disney or Einstein or you name it. The stories are out there. We need to be really careful who we think can't learn.
Thank you. Speaker Minutes.
One of the sound bites I've gotten in my office is females are outpacing males significantly in colleges. And I've also heard from, say, building trades and those kinds of professions that the voc tech component of high schools need to be beefed up. We need to do more. Could you speak to those two issues?
Absolutely. And my work in North Clackamas really built a passion for me. We talk about college ready, but what we want are students who are prepared for the world that's out there, their choice whether they go literally to four-year or two-year college or into a training program. But what the latest data is showing us, particularly through the Achieve data, if you've seen that out of the Education Trust, is whether you're going into manufacturing or construction, a two-year college or four-year college, the skill level you need in reading, writing, and math in particular is the same. And so what we need in our professional technical programs is not what I would call the vocational program of the 1960s that may have taught me just the skill of the industry, but we need students learning those skills either because they're going to go into those as a career or because it's their current passion and that's what keeps them in learning, and also learning through that passion in the manufacturing class or the welding class or the engineering class, whatever it is, asking me in that class through that work to operate at high levels of math, English, and reading. And there are some examples of that happening. The largest body of research is the Southern Regional Educational Board, which is actually one of the first high school reform models. I think there are 15 years out there. 20-some states have schools in them. And they're particularly looking at a melding of what used to be vocational with high standards so that all students graduate with both. And they have some wonderful models of how to do that. North Clackamas' Sabin Center is another example, so that our professional technical programs are at industry standards as well as helping those students access reading, writing, and math at the academic standards. And there are some examples of that happening. I think our community colleges can help us do that, too.
And then do we know why it seems that women are outpacing males, females outpacing males in the college enrollment? Do you know what's causing that? Or
we don't. I don't know the answer to that. It's a national
maturity level.
I'm trying not to get into the...
This is a chance to get it on an official record.
Representative of Bakken. I'm shocked that you would say that.
One might say it's about time, but that's probably not appropriate. I do want to mention, in terms of the continuum that Jill has talked about in the work that we're doing, the small schools model is just one model of high school reform, but some examples of a seamless articulation model, so wherever a student is in learning, if I'm third grade reading in high school, what supports do I get to catch up? Or if I'm a student who is a junior or senior in age, but I'm ready for college work, why can't I be doing college work instead of the senior year where I take one required class and I'm out there goofing off for a year and I find the first year in college very hard because I haven't been doing any schoolwork? An example that just opened this year in Oregon, and I could show you lots across the nation. In fact, the international school that I showed you at LaGuardia is an early college model. Salem Kaiser in Chemeketa just opened an early college school on the Chemeketa campus. That is high school students physically on the college campus finishing their, or actually all of their 4 years of high school career, where the courses I take, particularly in my last 2 years, are college courses that count for high school. And unlike the dual credit, which is a good program, we use that in lots of schools and colleges in Oregon, but dual credit is I take a course here or there, I might do math, English, may or may not move you forward as you articulate into college. In the early college model, it's a planned program. And the goal of early college is you graduate with a high school diploma and an AA degree at the same time. And we do have schools across the nation who are doing that. So there's a seamless articulation. If you're ready, you should be able to move into that model. We've mentioned that we need to align the high school test with college admissions. If I'm going to be tested to see how I'm doing in high school, shouldn't it inform, am I ready to move on past high school. There are six states who are looking specifically at using current college admission for doing that. I happen to know intermediaries like E3 in Illinois, Colorado, and Maine, and so I've talked to them. How is this working? Illinois and Colorado are using the ACT as their state assessment test of how kids are doing, and it also immediately informs them, oh, am I ready to move on to college, and where are my areas of remediation? According to educators that I've asked, they say that's moving the system in a direction it wasn't before, with more students seeing themselves as college ready and our system more aligned in getting students ready. Maine just started that last year, but their initial take on using the SAT is this is a positive thing. We think this is causing a good result. It's something for Oregon to talk about. I did mention that we need to provide adequate support for the underachieving. So, for instance, when North Eugene put in that AP English for All, and I said they had a certified English teacher every period of the day, well, if that's six or seven periods, the cost of that to North Eugene was about 1.2 FTE. So there is a cost in doing this and raising the bar. Will need supports, but it might not be the cost that we think it is. And then lastly, in terms of graduation requirements for all, I know the board has very specific leanings in terms of what those requirement changes should be. They've been looking at those 22 states working with the American Diploma Project. I just want to share with you that one example is Indiana have what they call a Core 40 in terms of they count their high school credits different than we do, is where they came up with 40. But they have some very specific high school credits that have been intentionally aligned with college admission. That 10 years ago, they offered it as an option for students to be encouraged to take these and you get an honors diploma. In working and putting that in place, the legislature voted it as graduation requirements for the class of 2011 with some years of piloting as an option ahead of time. And during those pilot years, they went from 13% of the students in the state meeting that graduation requirement, while it was still optional, to 65% under optional. And then, as I said, in the class of 2011, it will be required. So, again, there are states we can turn to who are doing some of these things, and we can learn from them.
Representative Gelzer, Representative Dahlem, did you have a question? No, Representative Gelzer.
I can let go.
Thank you. Representative Roblin.
Thank you. Just a real quick one. You know, when you mentioned the issues about having the extra help for the people at North Eugene, I wish you'd also explain, say at the same time, that is part of the definition of equity. Because I think if the more we say it and the more we acknowledge what equity really is, which is all students getting there, as opposed to the word that people misrepresent often, it would be helpful for us. So
thank
I just wanted
to. I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You
that was very informative.
I'm sorry,
and we.
I have one question.
Oh, Representative Avakian.
I'm sorry. I thought you were done.
We do need to move on, and so let's skip those.
Question.
Okay. No. Then my question is this: the many of my colleagues and I are very interested in making sure that other curriculums, such as music, art, physical education, maintains an equal place in schools. How, with the math and the science and English, how does the small school accommodate things like 120-member marching band mm-hmm. or an 80-member choir?
That's a good question.
And Speaker's Menace question, which I think is so important, about the apprenticeship programs. I know the Beaverton District used to have, without being too nostalgic, but used to have apprenticeship programs in the trades all the way back to the seventh grade, and they've been eliminated not only in the middle schools, but in the high schools as well. And those are programs that accommodated sometimes 50, 60 kids at a
right.
time. So how does it accommodate those types of curriculum?
To take them one at a time, in the conversion schools, usually choir and band that take 100 and some students to really make a strong program tend to be a course that we call crossover courses that all of the small schools share. Mm-hmm. So, and they offer them the first thing in the morning or the last thing in the day. So they, again, the conversion schools work together to say, are there a few courses that we couldn't easily replicate each of us individually? In terms of the breadth of elective classes, which may or may not be the professional technical classes. The individual small schools, and this is where we're asking for significant change, cannot duplicate the breadth of a school of 1900 can offer much more elective classes than Fossil High School that has five teachers. However, what we need to do is look at two things. The number, the percentage of students out of a total high school who actually take advantage of a breadth of electives tends to be 25% or less. So are we holding hostage good education for all students for a smaller segment of our student body? And secondly, we should ask, what do electives do best? And usually what they've done for students is they connect me with an adult who has a passion just like mine. And that tends to be, talk to students about the stories of high schools, my art teacher, my band teacher, my athletic coach, who I really connected with. So it was about adult connection with someone who has my passion and the opportunity to explore my passion. What we're finding in small schools that are doing well with students is those type of opportunities can also be replicated, maybe even better, for the high school student in the real world setting with partnerships with those outside of the high school, the community college, the youth symphony, the internships at a particular job. So that's one way of providing those opportunities. Another way that professional technical is a program is some schools, as in North Eugene, are themed schools. So it may be that the arts reside within one school very deeply, and then there's a broader general band for all students. So those are some examples of how they address those.
Thank you, Karen. I think that was, I hope that was helpful to you in sort of imagining and putting some reality around this notion of a continuum that's a little hard to think about on its own, but that we think is a very, very powerful concept. And in order to make that work, we are proposing to you that the entire budget process really needs to be rethought. And in order to do that, we have John Taponia, who is familiar to you because of his work with Chalkboard, but I want it to go on the record that OBC had him first. It's a long and wonderful relationship, and John has become, I think, not only in Oregon, but nationally, one of the outstanding people in the field of really looking at school budget and figuring out what in the world do these things mean. So one of the things he'll be talking with you about is why transparency, as well as connecting budgets to performance, is so important. So John, I'm going to let you just go on into your presentation.
All right. Thank you, Jill. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Taponia. I'm a managing director for Echo Northwest. And the budget, I think these folks have recognized, is a critical piece if they are going to advocate for the revolution and change that they're seeking. In our view and in my view in helping them and consulting on this, I think Oregon has, in terms of it, both the budget process and the information that you as a body and other legislative bodies, school boards, et cetera, are reviewing in terms of making school decisions and investment decisions, has been inadequate. And good information is out there. I don't think it has been presented to you in a way that has allowed you to make the best decisions you could have made over time. And a radical overhaul of the budget, both in terms of the process and the decisions, how they are presented to you, in what groupings they are presented to you, and how the information is presented to you, I think will help you understand both where you have been, how you got here, and give you a better sense of where you might want to go from here. There's going to be, we are at a crossroads at this point in time. This may be a legislative session that does have some room to consider some investments, unlike most recent sessions have had. But at the same time, on the near horizon, you have other parts of the general fund, Medicaid in particular, that are going to be competing very aggressively for those general fund resources. So you have to be very smart and deliberate about what you do on the education part of the budget as you go forward. And so that is a general overview is driving why Oregon Business Council and Chalkboard and others have recently called for more transparency and a greater tie to performance measures in the budget process. Looking at this slide, it starts to tell the story of three different ways that Oregon currently budgets for education, at least here at the state level. In the pre-K through 12th grade area, we would consider it a limited performance-based budget. You make a large appropriation. There is a fair amount of detail reported back to you and available to you in terms of how that money is spent. And there are some performance measures, and increasingly so over the course of the past 10 years in terms of standards and benchmarks, but not nearly as many as there should be. So what we would characterize as a limited performance-based budget. In terms of the way that the state reviews or considers the K-12 budget, looking at the governor's budget and the official numbers, there's only 440 full-time equivalent positions that are reported in that, because you are considering only those who are in the Department of Education in that budget. But there are some 55,000 employees of K-12 in districts that are also being compensated through state resources and local resources as well. At the community college level, much more detached than at K-12. There we would consider the budget method more of a grant and aid program, where an appropriation is set for the community colleges. It's then sent out to the various institutions, and very little is sent back in terms of detailed understanding of how those resources are spent, the amount that is spent per student, the amount that is spent on salaries versus benefits versus supplies, et cetera. Just in terms of our own attempt to gather information there, much more difficult to get good budget information unless you go literally community college by community college and extract them from them directly. So much less information there than you have at K-12. And then just looking at in the state's budget how they report the FTEs, you've got 49 FTEs there associated, a very small endeavor at the state level in terms of community colleges. By contrast, the Oregon University system, much of that endeavor is considered to be directly under state control, and it's much more of a line item budget. So you have this real difference depending on what level you're talking about, in different levels of control, different levels of information that you have as a state that is coming back to you about how those resources are being spent. This next slide is the standard, if you go into the governor's budget, is the standard introduction that derives, in my mind, derives the policy debate and summarizes, and this was for the 05-07 budget, summarizes the investment that the governor was requesting at that point in time. This presentation, in my mind, is a disaster. It really conveys no useful information to anyone other than someone who might be sitting in a budget agency. And there are a whole host of things that are wrong with it. First of all, these are all biennial numbers, which only people in Oregon understand because you happen to budget on a two-year cycle. conveys some of the dollars that are spent in the education enterprise, but not all of them. Some local dollars are considered in these amounts, others are not. Some tuition amounts are considered in this budget or represented in this budget, others are not. It does consider some of the positions, like I said. If you look down at the bottom at full-time equivalent employees, most of the Oregon University System employees are counted in this budget, but community college and K-12 employees who are supported by those funds are not. So if you were just a lay person reviewing this budget and you saw the amount of money that was being appropriated here and the number of positions that they were supporting, you would conclude that these are tremendously well-compensated individuals. So all of this is to say, on a number of occasions, Duncan and Jill have called over and they've seen a change in this presentation. They've said, well, how are we doing? Can you tell me where have the investments changed? How has spending changed? How has spending per student changed? And this presentation provides no good information on that topic and is, even as a graduate of the U.S. Congressional Budget Office, I find it terribly difficult and frustrating to work through. And as complex and unhelpful as that presentation is, it nonetheless is a major driver. That presentation drives the way we talk about the budget and drives the way that Oregonians debate the budget over their coffee in the morning. Just a couple of quotes. First from Susan Castillo, we will talk in terms of billions of dollars. The average person knows that $5 billion, which is what the governor is proposing, is a lot of money. Many people will be asking why $5 billion isn't enough to provide the quality education that we want for our state. Well, why are Oregonians at their coffee tables talking about $5 billion? It's a biennial number. It's actually not all the money that would be spent on K-12 during those 2 years. And it has no relationship to the number of students that we're trying to serve or the different kinds of students that we're trying to serve. So it's not a terribly helpful number. And then another quote from then House Majority Leader Karen Minnis.
What did I
say? Very hard to examine from Salem how each school board allocates its money. Why is it when we give general increases each session, it never seems to meet the perceived need? Well, I can thank you, Madam Speaker, for having uttered that, because on that same day, April 10th, the Oregon School Boards Association came into my office and they said, John, you got to help us sort this out because we don't understand how much is being spent and how it's changed over time. And so this, in essence, launched a series of projects that there were that quote and the article that it appeared in launched a series of projects that led me here today. And hopefully a step toward more transparency and better understanding of among public officials. So for K-12, why are Oregonians debating 5 versus 5.4? That was the last debate. I know 6 is going to be one number in this one. I don't know what the other one, 5.7 or 5.6, but there will be a debate. The competing figures cover 2 years. They capture only a share of the total resources for the anticipated K-12 budget. They represent funding for a range of activities with varying purposes, goals, and expected outcomes. So you've got in K-12, a big lump that we have some performance measures for in terms of reading and mathematics benchmarks, et cetera. But there's a lot else, a lot of other things going on in that budget that don't necessarily translate into those forms of performance. We have student transportation that doesn't directly impact reading scores or math. And what are we expecting out of those investments? And I think most importantly, it lacks any reference to the number of children served and what the resources are going to buy for those children. So it's completely divorced of the clients, the kids that we're trying to serve. Meanwhile, the higher ed budget anchors this funding debate at a similarly aggregated yet incomplete and publicly inaccessible level. And it requires separate funding decisions for comparable services delivered by different institutions. So you've got, as you've mentioned, high schools, community colleges, and the Oregon University System in many cases delivering similar services, but we're having different debates in different committees and budgeting for those what could be complementary and aligned services in different different committees and different debates. The consequence of what I would call opaque budgeting that dominated the 1990s and the period before that has left to or resulted in spending adrift, as I characterize it here. OBC a couple of years ago asked us, Echo Northwest, to look at the change in per-student spending for a number of different activities across the continuum, and we came up with this estimate between 1991 and 2003, where you can see that there were increases in pre-kindergarten and in K-12 special education spending and in community college developmental education spending in real terms, but either stagnant or sizable decreases in all the other categories across the continuum. And it wasn't so much that people didn't understand that that was going on. I think this was the first attempt to estimate it. And it took people by surprise, the extent of the magnitude of the changes in the various categories. And I would contend that if Oregon had budgeted in a transparent way throughout that decade, they wouldn't have been surprised by these trends because they would have been reviewing them and debating them every step along the way. And the answer very well could have come out to be identical to the one that you have in front of you, but at least 10, 12 years after the fact, you wouldn't have been surprised by that answer. So what would the characteristics of a transparent performance-based education budget consist of? It would span the pre-K-20 continuum, so it would look across the continuum. It would report annual in addition to biennial appropriations and historic expenditures. It would outline available per-student funding from all public and private sources, and I think that's critical because you need to understand not only what you are in charge of and what you are appropriating, but you need to know what you are appropriating into. There are other funders out there. There were changes in local funding over the course of the 90s through property tax limitations. And there were changes in federal appropriations over the course of the 90s. And we anticipate there will be continued changes in federal appropriations in the future. And so anybody that is appropriating the sizable resources into that system should have a sense of the entirety of the budget, not only their subset of it. The next feature would be that it would isolate programs only if they are sizable in scale and have a unique purpose. So rather than simply putting out the $5.4 billion and saying, here's K-12, and pushing it off, you would look through and say, okay, are there programs within this $5.4 billion that have purposes that are unique from other programs within that, and break them out so that you can follow spending both historically, anticipate it going forward, and then start to follow the performance for those programs and get a sense as to whether those investments are actually returning what you're hoping they would return. And then, and as important as any of these preceding points, you would establish explicit performance expectations for each program. And I think that's the critical last piece in that when you are appropriating in large lump sums, there are a number of very important programs that in scale are larger than, say, the Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Energy, and any other number of programs that you folks spend an awful lot of time debating budgets over, that simply go through this process without any rigorous debate or review based on the budget process that you have now.
John, Representative Dolan has a question.
I'm going to give you two choices, perhaps, and then you'll give me the right one. Would that look like, when we looked at that last chart and we've allocated what appears to rather large growth in preschool, we would then say, well, it looks like financially we've not only abandoned the middle school, but we've underfunded them. So when we say expectations, we know middle school performance from what we heard in the education committee was not good. So we would use this to target money to where we want it to be good. We wouldn't say it would be a positive rather than a negative, I'm assuming.
Yes, that you would have a clear understanding of where your investments have been and where they are headed, and you would also refine your expectations for the performance associated with those investments going forward. But I think you would have to look very carefully and characterize where you believe performance will be impacted by any of these investments. I think the Children's Institute would come forward and say that an investment in pre-kindergarten will not only affect performance at that level, but an investment in pre-kindergarten will affect third grade scores and hopefully even eighth grade scores down the road. So,
Speaker Minnis.
Thank you. I remember now when I made that quote, and people were upset that I asked the question. I was surprised by that because it was an honest question. You know, we need very good information and transparent information and all the information because I don't know a person in this assembly that doesn't have a desire to fund our education system and do a good job of it. And sometimes it seems like it's a struggle to get good, transparent, accurate information so we can make good, sound decisions in that process. You mentioned the pre-K versus middle school. And just to follow up on that, now, we write a big check here at the state level. We have very little impact on how those dollars are allocated. Would you speak to that and suggest to us how that can be addressed?
Right. There will, as you move into better information at the state level, and understanding better where you are making appropriations now and where local school boards have decided to take that money and spend it themselves, there will be a question about governance. And as you get into more detail, I think there will be a fear that you are going to get into the details of governance and try to direct what local school boards are doing with their resources. But rather, I think the more appropriate way to view this is that you need to understand better where local school boards are spending their money and not dictate that a particular line item, if it were to be disaggregated in this way, has to be spent on that activity. If a local school board receives dollars that came under the middle school piece, but was doing well in middle school and could reinvest that in the earlier grades because their middle school performance was doing what they wanted it to do, they should be able to do that. But they have to then come back and show you that their performance at the level where they've taken the money from is strong. So this is, I think, by reorganizing this budget and for you being able to better track the investments and the performance, it then allows you down the road to see where performance is lacking to start asking questions. Right now, you do implicitly appropriate for ESL and special education through the formula. You create the $5.4 billion, but then it runs through the machine, and there are implicit appropriations. Only a handful of people know what that implicit appropriation is. Jim Scherzinger usually figures it out, and he could tell you how much that is. But there hasn't been over time any sort of careful look at, okay, what is that implicit appropriation? What are school districts deciding to spend in relation to that implicit appropriation that you're making, and what is the performance of the students that are being served with those dollars? How do students who are either severely disabled in separate settings, how are their achievement scores comparing to those students that are not in that classification, and how has that changed over time? Is that a widening gap? Is it a decreasing gap? Or students that are in a regular setting and receiving special ed but through a mainstream program? How have those students, how have their numbers changed? How much are we spending per student? how have their scores on reading and mathematics and science and the like changed relative to students that are not in that category over time? Those are a lot of questions that, as spending in that category has accelerated over time, that this state and local school board should be asking, but they simply haven't been asking. And whether that results in more or less money being appropriated for those activities is an open question. But the information isn't there upon which to start asking appropriate questions about the performance of those programs, because the debate, certainly at this level, has simply been between $5 and $5.4 billion.
And as many speculate, then it would appear we're shooting from the hip. Representative Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. And again, that last graph, I think, is a really good one, because it also, there's another implication there, and that is that there are federal legislation mm-hmm. that require districts yes. to spend money mm-hmm. that the state gives them.
Mm-hmm.
Special education is the greatest example. You know, while everyone else is going down, mm-hmm. money would continue to go there because there is a rule, a law right. that says you will not do less than you did the year before. And so then you look at that, and you'll also look and you'll see high schools and middle schools got less. Well, they were the only places in the system
right.
where there were electives and other kinds of courses we talked about before. And so it was the only choice the school districts had, was to remove money from that part of the system. It had nothing to do with the achievement or any of the other goals of the system. It had to do with maintaining a system in a very difficult time.
Right.
And so people made decisions.
Your point is an excellent one, and I think where a more transparent and disaggregated budget would take you is, imagine a hearing where you had a day on that line item, and you saw the history of where that was going, but you also had the budget analyst coming forward and telling you, well, these are the constraints that we have. There is this federal law, and we are required to spend money in this category, and this is how we're doing with that money. And then you could start to refine your goals, maybe, you know, talk to the federal government or the federal delegation about special education, its role in it, how much they're supporting and how much you are. But without it in the current framework, there really isn't time that's devoted and spent on that.
No, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gelser, then Representative Farr.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think one of the benefits of that transparency as well is that connection to outcomes. And if you look at that increase in spending in special education, for example, and you think about what we heard in the earlier presentation, while spending has increased, our expectations for that population of students and their mm-hmm. outcomes mm-hmm. have not. So if we continue to spend money and we know that we have maybe 1% of students that can't achieve a high school diploma, mm-hmm. and yet we know we have far more that aren't, because at the middle school level we start telling these kids, we know you're not going to graduate, so your school day is digging cans out of a garbage can all day or cleaning the cafeteria, in an expectation-linked budget, we would be able to link some outcomes and accountability to the money that's spent there. And I think in the long run, that benefits all students.
Well, I think the other aspect that is helpful through the transparent budget is there are a number of commentators and analysts who have an average number in their head for $7,500 per student or $8,000 per student, but really that average is composed of a variety of different programs and costs per student. You have a small number of students where you're spending, or districts are spending, in excess of $20,000 per student. You have another category of students where you're at $13,000-$14,000 a student, and then some students at $5,000 or $6,000 per student. It adds to the complexity. It makes the debate more complicated. But I think it's the only way to competently go forward in this state, given the need for change, and given the challenges that you have on the horizon, both within the education system and outside of it.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, my question is this. When you talk about the transparent budget and you're talking about individual school districts where someone can go online, and I'm assuming you're probably in accordance with the Chalkboard Project, the whole idea of me as a parent being able to go online and look at how my school district is allocating funds. Will I be able to go online and see how much my school district is spending on, say, teacher salaries, beginning teacher salaries, teachers that, you know, have been teaching for a number of years and have reached their maximum pay scale, how much they spend on benefits such as health insurance and retirement funds?
That would certainly be the goal. We need to think about all the different actors that could benefit from budget transparency, but there are certainly some vehicles that are going to be critical for a policymaker, a school board member, a state representative, a senator, et cetera, and other tools that are more appropriate for parents. And I don't think they're exactly the same tools, but they need to be driven by the same data, and they need to be consistent in their consistent, at least the high level on their presentation.
Quick follow-up. So I guess this isn't as much a question as just a point of clarification. So you're saying that the goal is to be able to provide that type of information that's set forth in a way that just the average member of our community could go online and understand how the funds are allocated, how their tax dollars are being spent.
Right, and now you're crossing into my multiple hats. The Chalkboard Project has launched with a number of partners the Open Books Project, which has it draws on the same data that we are drawing on here to give clear, accurate, and concise information to parents. I think it's in its sort of first version, and they are already getting sort of feedback on what more the general public would like to learn. But it goes a long way from the database initiative, which, even from my perspective, was as a consumer, a parental consumer, difficult to digest. And so I think the Chalkboard Project has made a great stride there in organizing the data in such a way that that it's accessible to the general public. But I think you, as policymakers and decision makers, are going to be required to even take a step further in terms of your ability to review, your appetite to review, and the details that you would review.
Representative Dahlem, and then John, Jill, and Duncan, in all due respect, I will continue to about 12:30-ish. Will that give you time to at least...
Our
staff needs to be out of here and going to a training.
Oh, absolutely. I was going to tell you that this hearing is a lot like my checkbook and me when I'm shopping. I haven't finished, but there's no more resource left. We're really out of time. And so I wanted to check with you to see what you would like.
Will that give you at least
that
I think a framework?
Even if we could have 15 minutes.
Yeah, at 12:30, I know that some of you might have
we'll just
opt yourself.
That'd be wonderful.
Totally understand.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Representative Dahlem.
John, what I see then is as a policy decision, and it's a two-part question, we would develop a format for preschool, K-12, community college, and the university system that had the same components in it, so that you could go across the spectrum. Then, with your budget experience and my public school experience, how long would it take for the public schools to be able to tip their practice so that we would all be reporting in a uniform style, at least the budget side?
Well, I think it would... You already have components in place at K-12 and the Oregon University system. You have rigorous accounting of salaries and benefits and a whole variety of different functions that schools spend on, and you have it at the community college level as well. So I believe all the raw materials are there to make this work. It's simply that they aren't put to use I guess I would refer you to this piece of information, which was left at your desks, which was our attempt a year and a half or 2 years ago to take the 2002-2003 school year budget and at least give you a flavor for the type of information you could have at your disposal. And this is just the very beginning of it. It would go much deeper than this. But moving across the columns, what you would want to know is, first and foremost, how many full-time equivalent students are you serving in these different programs? And then stepping across, how much are you spending per student as a state? So that would give you a sense from your perspective, sitting here in Salem, how much of this are we responsible for, or have we been responsible for? And then how much are our local governments responsible for? How much has the federal government and other grants supported? And then how much are we asking to students and their parents in terms of tuition and fees until you get to the point of a total? And then look at the total state and local government investment and do that over time. Then the critical last piece is, having broken out that spending by its constituent parts, what are the performance expectations for each of these programs? And this is just the beginning of our thinking on those performance expectations. We have a number of the pieces in place. There, as Duncan pointed out, standards-based reform in K-12 has made great strides in the course of the past 10 to 15 years in terms of tracking where students are. And a lot of that is in place in K-12. But, like I pointed out with special ed and others have before me, or English as a second language, or a number of different activities at the community college and college level, there aren't explicit goals in place for programs that are being operated under this education umbrella that nonetheless we're devoting some pretty considerable resources for. What are the goals of student transportation? How much are we asking parents to share in the cost of that? And if not, why not? How much, there are different goals for student transportation for special education students, and that comes at a different cost. On down the list. So you can see that we have separated this into about 20 programs at this point. Those don't necessarily have to be the 20 programs that that would make sense for the long run, but they did. The current accounting allowed us to do that at this point, and I think with more work and effort, we could refine that, ask more questions about whether these programs make sense and whether the performance expectations. I think one of the key points over on the performance piece are there's a whole host of these that we don't gather any data on right now in terms of performance expectations. And as you pull out the program and then ask yourself, do we ask anything now? And if not, how would we get the information? There are a lot of missing pieces.
Representative Wisnett, did you have a question?
I wanted to know if, thank you, Madam Chair. I want to know if she's finished. I have several questions. I want to get my questions in before.
Oh, well, certainly. I have some questions that I'm going to leave with them as well and ask them to answer them through Jim Keller so that we can have some responses. But I'll provide you the opportunity. Are you telling me that you're leaving early?
No, but I just want to know if John's finished. Okay. Are you finished?
I'm finished with my PowerPoint, yes.
Okay, good. Well, I think, Madam Chair, if I may?
Yes, you may.
I think this is well done. I like it a lot better than the chalkboard presentations about transparency, so I don't know how you... This goes the whole spectrum. I'd like to mention your last paragraph. The creation of transparent performance-driven budgets is a necessary first step for more reforms to Oregon's pre-K-12 education. First step is we've got to have transparency and know where the money's going. I think that's important. I'll write down some of the questions and get them to you, or maybe talk to you about this one-on-one. The chart indicating that we're underfunding community colleges and higher ed, I mean, that's that's got to be out there. The public has to realize that. We've got to use that in our budget. Also, speaking from my district, you say one of the big cost drivers is that inter-district equalization of student revenue, which generates a transfer revenue from property wealthy districts to property poor districts, is driving the cost, is a big cost concern. And I ask you, you don't address that or how to solve that. Even into the community college, we're in a situation in Central Oregon where we're about ready to, we're going to be paying the state money instead of taking any money from the state. We're probably ready to go to privatize our community college because we're not getting any money from the state. And we have school districts in the same situation that are getting very little money from the school district, from the state. They're getting it all from the property tax. So you don't address that, or you don't have a suggestion, or help me, or and you don't address the school distribution formula, which to me is antiquated and a cause of great problem.
Well, I would say that this does very aggressively address the formula, in that what it's doing is making explicit what the formula at K-12 is distributing. Right now, you have an extremely opaque appropriation, some to general K-12 services, some that is sort of loosely earmarked to special education through the weighting, some that's loosely earmarked to teen parenting, some that's loosely earmarked to English as a second language. But again, the only people who really follow that are maybe a half a dozen superintendents that do the math and follow that. So I would say that that this drives inevitably a conversation, a very deep conversation about the formula and its constituent parts. I think, in addition, with respect to equalization, transparency. Transparent budget information would make taxpayers and policymakers aware of the transition that took place. I think in places like Portland and Beaverton, where over the course of the 90s, they implicitly were transferring some income taxes out of their areas and into property poor areas of the state, that took place without their really knowing that it was happening. And so as their appropriations weren't growing as fast as some in the rest of the state, they saw the erosion of arts and music and programs, advanced placement and the like, without really knowing why it was happening. But I think a clear budget presentation would have, at least for those who pay attention to such matters, would have made that clear to them earlier.
Madam Chair, just one follow-up. And I think this is a great white paper, but we're looking for you. We haven't been able to do it. I've been working education for 3 years, and it didn't take me long to figure out we have a problem with the distribution formula, and then I'm told you can't change it because you got winners and losers. You're an independent organization. You've got to come in and tell us we've got to change it.
And as an advisory, the Interim House Committee on Education and Revenue will be meeting jointly to have Distribution Formula 101. So any members here that would be interested in joining, I'm sure that would be amenable.
So just a quick comment, what we're saying is budgeting and distribution are part of the same process, really. We balkanize them. We have a revenue committee that does distribution. You have ways and means. You have the state board does the community college, and the higher ed board does the higher ed distribution. These are all, if you think about it in the way John is describing it, you would be thinking about this all very differently, and you will have to, and this is a point we'll be making as we close here, is if you want to do this, you not only have to think about how you structure the budget, you're going to have to think about the budget process itself and how all of the systems work. We don't have, and I would stress, we do not have the magic answer, but what we do have, if you're interested in taking this issue on, and it will involve institutional change at a pretty high level, we would be more than eager to help you try to have the resources to think it through, because there's a lot of design work that would have to get done to make this happen.
Have you talked to the Joint Ways and Means, I'm speaking on chair, have you talked to the Legislative Fiscal about their presentation? Have you had any conversations with them?
We've talked with the members of the Ways and Means and some of the, and the staff, but we need to do more.
But staff, have you spoken directly to staff about,
yes.
And
They're participating in some of the conversations we're having, in particular the education staff. So, yes.
And I think that
But I would say we have not discussed any of this enough to really be ready for where the level of change we need.
Emphasizes that there are isolated conversations or in various areas going on, and there is no link. We need to gather around that because this is a significant issue facing the state. Representative Bellum.
John, what I would like to see, and we are bumping on in this committee three separate issues. One is the budget, which to me is what do we plan for. The other is how do we distribute the money, which may or may not have any correlation with the budget. You get your money predicated on the number of kids you have in a certain category. And the third issue is neither budget nor allocation, but how do you spend it? And I think we need a spreadsheet like mm-hmm. this mm-hmm. that is very clear, comprehensible to anyone, that shows all three of those areas. Mm-hmm. When we talk about allocation, I think I've made my point. I can go on for 30
that's
minutes.
It.
That's probably
but you
it.
Won't.
You've got the, that's it.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
Madam Chair and committee members, in recognition that we are way past your time, and we still have actually a whole
2 hours,
that third leg of the stool before this thing gets planted. What Duncan and I will do is just kind of vamp through quickly what we were going to show you in more detail about the third infrastructure piece, which needs to be changed, which is the data system. It clearly, both from looking at this from the student's perspective in the education continuum and from thinking about what you could know and what you need to know from the budget process, the clarity and the quality and availability and the transparency of data is absolutely key. And that really comes at two levels. One, at the individual student level, moving all the way across with the student, and the other is kind of at the institution level so that you can test to see how well various schools and institutions are doing in terms of delivering the services and producing the results that you are buying with those public dollars. Duncan, you might want to speak a little about that.
Well, again, just really touch on it briefly. We first of all appreciate the support the legislature provided on the data initiative last time, but our vision is electronic student record that carries with the student all the way through their education experience. And again, you provided resources to support that. From the student's point of view, it'll make life much easier and it actually creates efficiencies for the system. But more fundamentally, we do need, as Jill says, data on schools and their performance. The database project was a great step. Jill provided leadership over a decade ago on that, but we need to take it to the next level. And the final piece, which we aren't going to have time, Kristen's been helping us on, imagine all of this information on the web and that spreadsheet that you just saw where you click and you can dig down more deeply about who's in the student population, what is the profile, what are the trends. We can design, we believe, a web-based tool that will provide a huge amount of information to you as policymakers to allow you to explore how the system is performing at every stage. And again, at some point, we'll provide you. It's probably easier to come and visit you separately. Anyway, it's a mock-up, but I think the potential for you to have a much richer set of information that you can use easily and ask a lot of questions will inform your policy making, which in a lot of ways is a good way of summarizing what all of our recommendations are about. What we're imagining, and Jill, maybe I'll close with my point of view and then Jill can close with hers, as one of you said, I can't remember, I lost track of the day, what this is really about is a different vision for education in Oregon. And the question really we're struggling with is who's going to lead Oregon to the future. It has to be at the state level. At the executive level, I'm participating on the board. The governor is very much focused on the enterprise, and there's a lot of work going on in the executive branch, and it's really good, and I'm really proud of what's happening. It also must happen at the legislative level. It can't be you all ultimately, as one of you said, decide where the budget goes, how it's going to be funded. You're the ultimate decision makers on it. And what we're really seeking from you is for you to be the proactive leader in education policy, to set a vision and then ask the systems to explain their performance against your vision and think about what changes you need to make, whether they're budget changes or policy changes, that will drive us to where we want to go. And to do that not just once in a special hearing at one point, but to make that a permanent part of your legislative process. That it can't be just the 2007 session, it's got to be every session from here on in, because this will not happen. The level of change we're talking about is not a two-year agenda, it's a 10-year agenda. And we need a bipartisan effort across the body, Senate as well as the House, that is thinking about this systematically. And I think the way, and I think it was Representative Roblin at the beginning, say the key is to stay true to a vision and having that. And so we spent a lot of time at the very beginning. We should probably spend more time. If we agree on the vision and then view the system's performance against that vision, then you'll be able to figure out what changes you need to make. And then over time, we'll make the changes that drive to where we want to go. Again, I just can't stress enough, it's not a one-time deal. It's you being engaged for a long period on these issues and changing your processes to support that kind of proactive change. We don't have the answer what that looks like. Again, we'd love to work with you on it. We have a lot of ideas we're happy to share, but in the end, it'll be your own institution and how you manage it. But we do believe it's large institutional change to make this happen.
That you are taking so much time and effort of your own really to deepen your understanding of these issues is a wonderful thing, and we're grateful that you included us in this little party. We're hoping that, as Duncan says, that if you want to continue with it, we'd certainly like to continue to help you think through. We're not bringing you a framework of bills and initiatives. What we're trying to bring you, at least initially, is, as we tried to suggest, really a framework for looking at this quite differently, for thinking about education as though it were the single most important piece of business that you do, that all of our futures are really quite dependent on the decisions that you make and the designs that you put in place for the future. So we do have a couple of sort of questions with implicit recommendations embedded in them for you. One of them is, could you do something of this nature for the whole body of legislators? Maybe begin the session with a hearing about education issues where you would bring in people from outside the state, from inside the state, and kind of lay out what you think is important and help everyone develop close to the level of proficiency that you will have by the time you're finished with your work. Just before the session begins. So that's one thing that we'd sort of like to offer you to think about. And another is to think about the extent to which your own processes might need to be reorganized and restructured in ways somewhat similar to the ways that the education ones might need to be. That your work also is somewhat siloed, and that to be able to see things in context and to look at policy and budget and the ways and means implications all at once might be extremely useful. But that, of course, would require some change and some revision of the way you view your own legislative processes. But it might also help you to move forward, to help sort of break out of just continuing to do things as you have done them, because it's how everyone's done them. And we've run out of that in the education system, I think, and what that system needs is really your help to lift them into the next level of structure and policy, which probably will require you to work a little bit differently as well. So thank you.
May I affirm for you, there are discussions already underway to revise how we go forward in the next session in regard to how we look at budget and policy and ways and means. So that discussion is percolating as a way to get to enhance the vision, because I think it's an very important part of this whole process. I can't thank you enough. I feel terribly that the checkbook is empty and there's still more shopping to do. I would like to, and I somehow we must try to facilitate, collectively or in small groups, however we can best make those meetings happen, because there's so much that has gone into your work that I know that probably all of us want to go deeper with you. The questions that I wanted to leave with you, that I hope you can provide some information offline to Jim Keller. A point that Representative Wisnett was posing in regard to the Gates grant for the Small Schools Initiative. And did I understand correctly that was targeted right now at planning and development, and once those schools are off the and they're currently funded in their respective areas, and they will not be left hanging?
If the schools they work with is...
Or we can answer online if you want to give a little bit more.
Short answer. Each of the schools we work with gets 4 years of funding, which takes them through 2 years of planning and 2 years after they've implemented their small schools. So their structure would be in place.
So then the funding component would come back to how do we make them continue.
And how do we sustain.
Exactly. Okay. And then piggybacking, I guess, on Representative Babakian's question in regard to apprenticeship programs.
Mm-hmm.
The partnership concept with especially Oregon Business Council is one of the premier and largest organizations dealing with businesses. Are there further opportunities to make those apprenticeship opportunities happen for students within business locales?
Oh.
And do you have something that you're looking at in that regard?
Do you want me to answer now?
If you like.
This is an area we've put a lot of passion. Gilligan, before she came to OBC, we started one of E3 at its beginning was really aimed at helping create more internships and partnerships, and we made huge headway at the state. We still have a long way to go to meet our vision, and I have a longer answer, but it's going to take the whole business community as a resource to support the internship.
To have buy-in.
And there are a lot of great examples. And what we found is the schools working in their communities are really they need to find their local partnerships. And that's a lot of what Renee is trying to do now, is organize local business groups to connect directly with their local schools. It's harder to do at a statewide basis. You have to get really close to the action, if you will. And that's been the way the strategy. But we still need to ramp up internships.
Well, helping the businesses in the areas where they do have local schools, letting them know that they can make that entree as well.
Yeah.
And AEA has a great, great model where mm-hmm. they provided scholarships and also internships in the businesses during summer. So it's a phenomenal program.
Mm-hmm.
And then to lead with you, if there is information that you might have available, I think to further probably resolve the question that Speaker Minnis was posing in regard to the numbers of women in the education arena now, and I know that there are a lot of dynamics that factor into that, but if you have anything that you can address that question for us, I think it would satisfy her.
Good.
Any further questions you would like to leave with our presenters today? Representative Wisnett?
I can do it offline, but it was during the... When you're talking about the goals, you're talking about, thank you, Madam Chair, you're talking about going from 7.3% graduating with associate degrees to 40%. I mean, that's a big jump. And how, do we have the instructors and the facilities to do that? I mean, that looked like...
can I answer that one? I want you to go back in history to 1960 and take a look at the data on what the population of educated adults was then. And I don't have it right in front of me, but it was roughly... about 8% had a college degree, only about 50% had a high school degree at the time. We made policy choices in the 50s and 60s to ramp up levels of education at the time to unprecedented levels. We have been flat for the last 20 years. We can do this. We've done it in the past. You have to have the vision. We can do it. There's no question we can do it. It's a question of will. It will take huge capacity. It's going to have capacity implications, no question. It's really, to me, it's a matter of will. But make no mistake, it has big implications to your point on capacity.
Well, Duncan, and I think I almost feel remiss not having the precise calculus here for vision times the knowledge of next steps times leadership times a couple of other components has to be greater than the opposition, and we must embrace that opposition in order to do better move forward.
That's right.
Did you have comment, question? Thank you so very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you. We look forward to further conversation. We really appreciate it.
Macy's has a sale this weekend.
Oh,
I have my mind.
He's always has a sale.
Anything further, Mr. Keller? Okay, our next meeting is September 27th. So this committee will be meeting next September 27th, and we stand adjourned. Thank you.